This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
December 3rd, 2017, and this is part two of the 2017 Psychology is Dead Top 50 Wrestlers Special. I am Quentin Moody, and less than 24 hours removed from part one of our adventure, Timothy is back with me to get back to doing our top 50 list. So, Timothy, no lollygagging. Are you ready to get back into it?
Let's do it, man. This is seamless. Right into it.
All right, I'll start off with my number 30. My number 30, guy you probably have higher, Mark Haskins.
He should be higher. Yes, I do have him higher.
All right.
So my number 30 is a guy who I think you said earlier, if I remember correctly, it's Mark, also Mark Andrews.
I had Mark Andrews at 32.
At 32. Okay, so pretty close. Mark Andrews, obviously, banner year for him as well. Not just in the fact that he kind of broke out in WWE in the UK Classic. He also was having really, really fantastic matches before that in Progress, in Attack Pro, in PWG. To me, he was actually one of the best... baby faces in PWG. I think he maybe had like one or two matches this year, though. Or actually, he may have not had any matches this year, technically, in PWG. But he's just one of the best baby faces on the planet. And he goes out there and he knocks out phenomenal matches with everyone. I mean, Pete Dunne, Mark Haskins, Kid Lykus, Will Ospreay, Tyler Bate, I mean, Dan Maloney, and then you add in his tag work. Already, like I said, talking about that with Eddie Dennis, pretty much. I hit all of his tag work stuff, but
the Jeff
if you take that...
from Progress Boston was really damn good.
Yeah, you add in all of his singles work on top of that, the Flamita match at Super Strong Style 16 this year, the tagging with Morgan Webster at, in some places... just amazing underdog babyface, super get into him. Because honestly, I mean, he's got this pop punk, Blink-182 bullshit vibe that realistically would drive me crazy normally. It's just not my thing. But with him, it really works because I just buy into him as the underdog. I really get into his work and everything he does. So he's just super likable, super nice guy, actually, outside of the ring, too, which, as of right now, is very important about what you're like outside of rings and how the way that you treat the fans. And he comes across super, super authentic. He runs Attack Pro, which I love their, you know, kind of their slogan for the company is we do it for the money, obviously, right? Just to really kind of push it over the top that they're all about their art form. He's got the Defend Indie Wrestling brand that he's been, you know, running for years and years, continuing to do that. His band is taking off. I talked about Big Time Important, kind of really enjoyed it. Talking about his angle with Pete Dunne at Download Fest this year in WWE that was all over the internet and such a big deal when I was doing the Making the Case for Pete Dunne podcast with Jamesy. Just like how he's involved with that super creative stuff as well with Pete Dunne. Pete Dunne is like one of my top guys preeminently. I really enjoy him, but Mark Andrews is really like his right-hand man when it comes to creativity work. I mean, they're actually the kind of super close confidants together. They work together on everything. So, I mean, you kind of have to understand that what they do in wrestling goes part and parcel with each other. The guys are definitely like involved with each other's careers so much. So yeah, I mean, and then like I said, on top of that, just phenomenal matches, everything with FSU, And then the turn with the FSU breakup, leading into hopefully an interesting storyline with Eddie Dennis going heel on him, could definitely be something to look forward to. So, yeah, I'm just a breakout year for him. Again, another guy who suffered a little bit from, you know, being signed to WWE, meaning that he worked a little bit less, or at least was a little bit less high profile for times in the year, especially when they're trying to figure out who's allowed to do what where. There was that kind of time in the middle of the year with streaming services and all the other issues.
And then,
where
and then Mark Andrews did get hurt early in the year too.
Yeah, he did get hurt as well. And then, yeah, he did get his bookings kind of were cut back a little bit just because you didn't know what he, where and what he could do. So realistically, I mean, I think that this is actually kind of a low spot for Mark Andrews based on his talent, but this is kind of where he's at based on his output for the year.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with everything you said there. I feel like Mark Andrews might be the most reliable guy in wrestling, honestly. I feel like you could just put him in any promotion, any setting, in a tag team match, singles match, opening match on the show, the main event, the first match after intermission, whatever. I feel like Mark Andrews is always going to deliver for you. Probably since Sami Zayn just hasn't been able to do much the last couple of years and has just been turned heel recently too, probably the best babyface in wrestling, the best consistent babyface in wrestling, since there's no one that's, I guess, as wholesome through and through in wrestling as Mark Andrews, besides maybe Kairi Hojo. I don't know. But yeah, I've loved Mark Andrews in pretty much every single match he's in. I wish I could have him higher, but like you said, the output was kind of hindered this year with signing that WWE contract and also getting hurt. So while I think every time he showed up on a screen, he was awesome, but he didn't have as much high-end stuff or the opportunity to have as much high-end stuff as the guys ahead of him.
Yeah, that's a fair take, and that's exactly the same kind of opinion I have. And you talk about the best babyface. I mean, I think that he's kind of hands down the modern wrestling right now's best babyface. I mean, I don't know. Kairi Hojo is a good comparison for sure, or a good competitor for him in that regard. But yeah, there's just something about him. You instantly get behind him, no questions, no matter where it's at, what the setting is.
All right, so my number 29 is Massive Yearn Simmons.
I don't have him on my list, and it's just because I got slightly behind on WXW, and realistically, I've liked a lot of his work, but I've seen him as kind of a lot quintessentially like the third to fifth most important guy in the company, right. And never really the most important guy this year in any setting.
Hmm. I can see where you're coming from on that. But I think where Yearn has succeeded for me in that in 2016, I definitely thought he was all character. A very great character, character keep in mind, but I thought that he was really getting by based on the character and that his in-ring wasn't really matching up. I think since turning babyface this year, that has completely changed. And while the Massive Yearn Simmons character is still very entertaining, he is very charismatic and very naturally likable. He speaks some very great English, and his promos in English are always awesome to me. His interaction with everybody on Shotgun, whether it be Walter, David Starr, the Mac, like whoever it is, I think he's always great on Shotgun and probably the best guy on it on a week-to-week basis. But besides that, I think in the ring this year, he's just been awesome. I think the match with Walter from the first London Calling show back in January was fantastic. I thought the title match against Axel Dieter Jr. From night 2 of 16 Carat was great. I thought his short brief title run with the WXW title was very good. Even up until he lost to Bad Bones, in which was admittedly a very screwy finish, I thought those matches were very good, even being hindered by interference. The WXW World Tag League run with David Starr as Massive Product. They didn't have as many great matches as I was hoping, but they did have that opening round match against A4 that I thought was the best match of the tournament. They had the final against Rincon that I thought was great too. So he has the tag stuff to boast. He has just enough singles matches that I think puts him ahead of some of the other WXW guys like Bad Bones, like the Mac, like Ilya. And I think he just has the personality to back all of it up too. So yeah, that's my case for Yearn. I can see seeing why he's like the maybe fifth most important guy in WXW this year when David Starr, Thatcher, Walter, Ilya, Bad Bones all exist. But I think Yearn Simmons, in a year where he's kind of been toned down, has shown that he has a lot of range. And I think this is also prepping him for a possible 2018-16 carat win.
Yeah, and that's definitely fair. And I would say that you're right about the tag league run for them. They really felt like they were the benchmark, and he was a big part of that. They did have that, you know, probably. I agree with you. I actually think that the A4 versus Massive Product match was the best match of the tournament. But a lot of the rest of the time, they felt like they were kind of the gold standard. While they weren't always having the craziest, spottiest matches, they were at the level of the top. They really felt like the kind of clandestine winners of the whole thing, which actually did help lead into the storyline. I think me and you both even talked about it, we thought it made the most sense because they clearly weren't going to go to David Starr feuding for the championship before Ilya's story kind of finished, and it seemed like Yearn was going to need something to do outside of the title picture as well, so putting them together and having a nice tag title run would have been perfect, but they kind of were able to use that expectation and twist it, having them lose to Ring Comp in the finals there to really kind of help, actually in some ways catapult them, which is another thing that I think Yearn probably doesn't get credit for, as you talked about there, is that he's a guy who has won and lost that title a bunch of times, the WXW heavyweight title, and it doesn't affect his overness in any way. He doesn't really need the belt. He works with it, and he actually feels like a guy who, when he has the belt, he elevates it and makes the belt feel more important. But when he doesn't have it, you don't feel like, oh, he's weaker because he lost the belt, which is really impressive. So, you know, maybe I was unfair on him and he should have been a little bit higher. And he should have been on my list, on my top 50 here. But I just couldn't get him there based more on the eyeball test than anything. But speaking of that, going into my next one, she was a eyeball test that was a negative on getting on my list for a long time until I really thought about it. And I think I was just being unfair. And that's Toni Storm. I don't know if you have her on your list.
No, don't have Toni on my list.
Okay, so the thing with Toni Storm is that I really had a kind of negative taste in my mouth. Like I said, eyeball test, I didn't feel like she deserved to be on the list. Based pretty much primarily on what you talked about yesterday with the Progress title thing. I really felt like Progress gave her the title as a swerve. There was no real point to it. They're just trying to shock people. I stopped and thought about it, and I'm like, well, Toni Storm was actually in the first or the second women's match, that four-way in Progress. I can't remember if it was the first match.
The first one was Super Strong Style 2015, and that was Jenny
versus Pollyanna.
And then I believe that you'd be right in saying that was like the second match. It was that four-way.
The second match was the four-way that had Dahlia, Polly, Jenny, and Toni, and yeah, Toni, I mean, she is Progress through and through. She was in the second women's match, so I shouldn't have really had that negative feeling about her winning the title. So then when I was doing kind of now putting my list together, I got over it, and I kind of had her name. And just looking at her compared to other people on the list, I was just kind of, well, it doesn't feel right to have that person above her, just with her output. I've seen her live a few times this year. Luckily, she's kind of comes out to the West Coast a little bit more. And she just never disappoints. Always really great matches. So it's just like pretty much every match is always super solid, great worker, really crisp, has this kind of dominance. She's really a kind of a walking tall baby face. She's never really has to do a lot of underdog fighting up stuff. Never, you know, and that might be, you could say that's maybe a depth in her game. I think the selling is when it's in, like, when she uses it, is done well. But yeah, she doesn't really sell a lot. She is more of a kind of, just unbeatable, keeps going through. Great match this year with TK Cooper and Lucha Forever when Dahlia was injured. He filled in for her and what was a fantastic match. It really stands out from early in the year. Mae Young Classic stuff, obviously. Great match with Kerry Hojo. I thought the Piper Niven match was fantastic. Actually, they always have great matches together. I almost feel bad for not getting Piper on my list, but I just felt that almost in the same way, she's a little bit too limited, even comparatively. Like Toni, at least has some situations where she shows that she can sell. Piper really does very minimal selling and is just the beast. And I think while she is very good at that, she isn't quite the same level. But yeah, I just thought fantastic in all of those matches. Great match with Kaylee Ray in progress this year that was really, like I said, really fucking good. Great matches, just phenomenal chemistry with Jenny almost every time they go at it. Match with Dahlia Black right back after Dahlia's injury in progress really felt like she really helped Dahlia, who was never, I think, a top-level female worker, really helped to make that feel like a pretty solid main event, or not main event, but heavyweight title match. And then the WXW Femme Fatale tournament, she was really the star of that thing the whole way through to me. Every one of her matches was phenomenal, probably, you know, 3.5-star minimum all the way up to like 4, 4.5 stars. Great match with Charlie Evans in progress after the progress women's tournament where Charlie Evans got the title shot. Going into that match, I really questioned Charlie Evans getting the shot, and Tony made sure to make that match feel like it made sense. So I think she did a great job there bringing her up. Then following that, great match with Lana Austin and Lucha Forever. Lana Austin, someone who she really needs a good partner to have a good match. And so it was like comparatively to me, the best Lana Austin matches I've seen are against Shayna and against Toni Storm. So, you know, I had Shayna on my list already because of how talented I think she is. Plus she works a style I really like. I couldn't shit on Toni because she was just as able to carry her, plus having so many other bigger matches with better women. Like I said, she doesn't, not a huge seller, but then when she goes up against someone like an Alex Windsor, who's also kind of a kick-ass character, she's able to just stand and bang, throw for throw. She'll show some weakness, but she stands up and she's tough, and she really exudes a natural charisma that the crowd obviously gets super behind. She's insanely over, great look. Just all around, I think, a star waiting to happen as soon as WWE gets ready to use her properly. Because, I mean, coming out of Mae Young Classic, she was the one everyone was talking about. And I guess you could argue that has some to do with her look. But, I mean, it also has to do with her charisma and her wrestling as well. She definitely stood out because there was plenty of good-looking girls in that tournament. But I felt like she was the one that a lot of people came out talking a lot about.
I think the thing with Toni this year for me is that she's really talented, and she's very young, and she has a very bright future ahead of her. I just could not bring myself to care about Toni Storm this year, and I was very shocked by that because I was very into her in 2016, the little bits of her I saw in 2015. So I've always was a fan of her, but I was expecting more growth from Toni this year, and she was always good in the ring. She's still having good, very good matches. But I just don't care about her. And I think whenever I'm watching these Progress Women's title defenses, or when I'm watching her whenever she shows up in Stardom, or watching her whenever she shows up in any other promotion across Europe, I didn't watch any of the Mae Young Classics, so I can't really give an opinion there. But I see her. She's having good, technically sound matches. She has a great entrance, a great look. But at the end of the day, I just don't care about Toni Storm. And maybe that's just not fair to her output and how much she was actually doing this year. But when I was actually trying to plot out my list, Toni Storm actually did cross my mind, but I never put her name down because I'm like, I can't really make a case for somebody that I don't care about.
Yeah, I can't blame you. And that was, again, that was kind of where I was at until I stopped and really thought about it. And I've liked so many of her matches so much that I couldn't. I wouldn't feel right just trying to at least give her fair shakes on it, you know? Mm.
So my number 28, a guy I'm assuming you have higher, Keith Lee.
Yeah, Keith Lee is higher for me. Yeah, we might still get to him tonight, though.
All right, you're 28.
So my 28 is, I think you had him lower, Kyle Fletcher.
I had Kyle Fletcher at 39.
39, all right. So, I mean, tell me why, Kyle, you had so low.
I think the reason why I kind of had Kyle and Mark Davis, for that matter, relatively low compared to how much I actually like these guys is because I was trying to maintain some kind of like semblance of fairness and not just put my favorite wrestlers like in the top 10, top 15, if they weren't really like on that level yet in terms of output, because they really have only been here for like 5, 6 months. And granted, that is a pretty good amount of time. for people that had just showed up and made an impact. But Mark Davis is my favorite wrestler to watch, but Kyle Fletcher is like just my favorite wrestler in general right now. He's kind of like hitting the Akira Tozawa sweet spot for me, where Akira Tozawa for a really long time was my favorite wrestler because I thought he was just so genuinely likable and easy to root for. And Kyle Fletcher just hits that for me. His goofy looking hair, he's a long string bean skinny kid, 19 years old. At first when you kind of see him, he moves kind of awkward. He has a big goofy face, but he's just the most endearing wrestler on the planet. You can't help but root for the guy. You can't help but love him. But other than all of that, the guy is fucking awesome in the ring. We already mentioned all the Aussie Open tag matches when we were talking about Mark Davis in the last episode, but Kyle Fletcher has a lot of very good singles matches, I'd say. One popping off the page right now to me is Kyle Fletcher versus Mark Haskins from Fight Club Pro, that I think is probably the best singles match either Kyle Fletcher or Mark Davis has had to date so far in the UK. You haven't gotten to this match yet, but Kyle Fletcher had a really interesting and good match with Dick Riley on a recent Attack show that I was very impressed by. I'm really impressed by Kyle in. But yeah, I love.
Actually, I just watched that last night.
Oh, you did?
And yeah, I actually really liked that match a lot. That Dick Riley guy was kind of interesting, but Kyle really made that match actually a lot better than I would have expected it to be.
Yeah. I think I've compared him to El Generico a lot, and the only difference between him and Generico, really, other than the mask and whatnot, is the fact that he's not a spectacular flyer as Generico was, but Fletcher can still do some pretty damn good looking flying spots when he wants to. His springboard crossbody to the floor always looks real good because the camera always catches it well, and just in particular how long his body is, it looks great. I feel like he always looks great flying through the air for the Aussie Open tag moves, but I can't get enough of Aussie Open. I can't get enough of Kyle Fletcher. I really can't like say any more good words about these guys. So, you should start talking now, so I stop rambling.
Yeah. No, I'm with you right there. I think, on top of it, just like we kind of both talked about this before, he had these really, really good singles match with Mark Haskins this year that kind of helps him stand out big time. He's really a much better, I think, standalone wrestler than Mark Davis has been this year as a singles wrestler. Mark Davis is starting to, I think he's going to break out, especially, honestly, we were both just talking about this before we started recording, but Mark Davis versus Thatcher in WXW, I actually think if Mark Davis continues to work WXW at least somewhat regularly, I think that's a place where he could really shine because he wrestles a style that fits in with that crew a lot better. Just because WXW is a lot of, I mean, their minimum guys are all pretty beefy unless you're like a total high flyer like DeMac or something. Everyone else is like pretty solid, you know? Mm-hmm. So a big solid guy like him who can move and throw people around and all that, that's a place for him. But this is about Kyle Fletcher who, on the rest of the indies, especially in the UK, Kyle Fletcher's size actually helps him. He's able to kind of mix in with a lot of different guys because there's a lot of really smaller guys. And unfortunately, I think a Mark Davis just couldn't have that same match with Mark Haskins just based on size. I mean, you can get into Kyle Fletcher as an underdog against someone like Mark Haskins. He can bump and sell for him, and it's believable. So I think that's a lot of what helps him stand out is that he's just had a better setting for his particular skills. Mm-hmm. Facial selling, facial reactions.
Amazing facial really expressions, yeah.
Yeah, over-the-top cartoony, but really works. And, you know, I talked about the Bugs Bunny thing that gets on my nerves. I think Kyle Fletcher's actually a cartoon character in the most perfect way. He's still believable as a big, goofy, kind of animated, over-the-top character that's just completely infectious. The whole crowd buys into him. So he's, to me, he's been a major standout. I was a lot less worried, I guess, than you about being impartial. All the people ahead of him, obviously, I think, had better years than him. But I don't think that anyone below him really deserves to be much higher than him, honestly. I mean, in ring, he's super fucking talented, and he has a lot of really great matches.
Yeah, and like to just get a final word in on Fletcher. I'm not sure there's a wrestler that left a bigger impression on me in 2017 than Kyle Fletcher. For the amount of time he's been here, for what he offers to a UK scene where a lot of guys are into that hard-hitting, high-flying style, I think he brings a sympathetic underdog character that we haven't been able to, that we haven't had in quite a while, I think. And I think if he gets the singles opportunities, that he could really catch fire and become like the next big breakout star in that scene.
Yeah, that's that is definitely the case. Now, I'm like getting excited for my next guy, so you got to do your 27 here. I got to hear what it is.
All right, my number 27 is someone that I think we've had a little bit of discussion about, but not sure if you have him higher than me. 27 is Hiromu Takahashi.
Hiromu didn't make my list this year. A lot of people suffered this year because of Best of the Super Juniors.
We had this talk.
Not delivering.
We had this talk, though, about like Hiromu specifically.
Yes.
Yeah.
I felt that he slowed down midway through the year, and a lot of the gimmickry stuff with Daryl and all that really started to affect my enjoyment of him. And, you know, that may be unfair, but to me, I feel like there was not a lot of output from him this year. But talk him up. Tell me why. Tell me why he's here for you.
Even though he fell off the radar, I would say after June. I can't really deny the fact that for the first half of the year, I thought Hiromu Takahashi, total package-wise, was probably like a top three wrestler in the world. I'm not just accounting for the fact of great matches or just personality or just look or everything combined together. I didn't think there were two or three better wrestlers in the world than Hiromu Takahashi. From wrestling perfectly to his character, to translating everything he learned in Mexico perfectly to the Hiromu Takahashi we got in New Japan up until a certain point. The mixed match leather jacket with all the different punk bands, the flag he carries, the balloons that would come down from the rafters. Everything was just so perfect about it. The way he walked, his facial expressions, everything about him was so well done in a presentation way. When he goes out there and wrestles, he's having these fast-paced, frenetic matches that still make sense when you watch them. Against Kushida, against Ricochet, against Titan, against Dragon Lee, against Willow Spray. So I thought he was still delivering in the ring up until we get to June. And after that, this is when we start to see the problems, because he suffered his first loss in the company in general. As far as the singles matches, I should say. The first night of the Super Junior tournament against Dragon Lee. Now, at first I was like, okay, he lost to Dragon Lee, that's his biggest rival. We can chalk that up, and he'll move on through the rest of the tournament. And then he loses a few more times after that. And now you start to see what the problem was, is that Hiromu had this star aura throughout the first half of the year, and then once Best of the Super Juniors goes on, he starts to lose it. And that is one of the most disheartening things that's happened this year, because I could not shut up about Hiromu Takahashi first half of the year. I thought 2018, 2019, you might be seeing this guy headline Super Bowl Hall shows, how different his presentation was, how good he looked, how big of a star he looked. It didn't matter how big he was. It didn't matter his size. He came across like the biggest star on every single show. And then by June, that all changes. And then by the time the G1 Climax starts, this is when the Daryl thing kicks in. And I had no problem with Daryl the first few times it happened. In theory, it made sense. People kind of came up with headcanons for it, that Daryl was his coping mechanism for losing the IWGP Junior Heavyweight title. That was all fine. I got it, and I was cool with it. Daryl then took a life of its own, and the company took notice of it. Hiromu took notice of it. Other wrestlers took notice of it. And Daryl became the attraction, and then Hiromu became the side piece. And that is something that really, really has damaged him as 2017 has went on, and it's probably going to damage him even going into 2018. And that's not to say that I think he's going to win the junior title back at Wrestle Kingdom 12, but I think everything they had going for them in the first half of the year with Hiromu is now really severely damaged because of the Daryl stuff taking on such a big life.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, you're right, but I also, like, I question just, like, what, how much does he really have when kind of he did start to lose a lot of his luster just because of losing matches? And I talked about it earlier about Yuron Simmons, how he could drop the title, he can drop losses, but he still feels like a big star, and how that's an important thing. I feel like Hiromu showed that he couldn't do that, and the Daryl gimmick.
Okay, I will say, I don't think it was the title necessarily. I think it was Hiromu stopped being cool. Hiromu was cool to me. It wasn't about him coming across like a big star because he had a belt to me. I thought Hiromu just seemed like a cool motherfucker. He just seemed like every time he came out through the curtain, even standing next to Tetsuya Naito, who's one of the coolest wrestlers on the planet, Hiromu seemed like just as cool as him, if not cooler. So it wasn't just like a star thing with me when it came to like having a belt and being able to be a star without a belt and elevate the belt. It's just that once the Daryl thing kicks into me, everything that made Hiromu cool kind of goes out the window.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. And I agree with you that the Daryl thing became the focus and he did become like a side attraction. He did have a decent match in What Culture Pro Wrestling against Lucky Kid. And and he was okay in the RPW junior kind of league that they did.
Well, yeah, him versus Speedball was good.
Yeah, but realistically, him outside of New Japan was not great either. So it was just kind of, he didn't, some of these guys you see and then they kind of fall off in New Japan, especially juniors, and you think like, oh, it's because the booking kind of sucks. Like Kushida is one last year who actually, Kushida didn't, I don't even think made my list this year because of so many of the juniors in New Japan just not being very good this year. And just really, like I said, Best of the Super Juniors was a big ticket, like feather in the cap for a lot of guys last year to help their cases, and then this year, I mean, there was very few good matches in Best of the Super Juniors, honestly. And Kushida, though, last year, what helped him a lot, too, was that his excursion stuff was always really good, so you could kind of see that while New Japan doesn't take juniors seriously, he's still a goddamn great worker and actually deserves a bigger push than he gets. But to me, Hiromu never showed that. Even outside of New Japan, he didn't take advantage of the opportunities that he had. And it could also be that, you know, what hurt him too is the LIJ gimmick is he's meant to kind of come across like he doesn't care. So he wasn't putting in a lot of effort. That's another thing. Kushida, when he was in other places, he always kind of acted like he was really happy to be there and all that. And it helped, I think, to put him over a lot. So that was kind of my hurt for him, too, is that, like, I could totally see what you say. I think that actually a big problem, too, is that he came out and he openly talked about wanting to move out of the juniors and not just be a junior, and then it felt like, oh, he got pigeonholed, and now he's just a junior who doesn't even have the title, he's not a big deal. And it really felt like he probably should have held the junior title until they were ready to push him up into heavyweight, which truth is they're probably never going to do that.
That's what everybody was, like, thinking at the time, is that you have this big star on your hands. Everyone thought Hiromu just had like star written all over him. When you have someone go over in less than 2 minutes in what was essentially the semi-main event of the show, at Sakura Genesis, when he beats Kushida, you're thinking, oh, he's not just a junior anymore if he's steamrolling Kushida like this. And then it just so happens that he's just another junior now. And that's really disheartening. Like, that you waste something that fucking cool, and then you look at this guy now, and you're like, well, what? Like, where are we going to go with this now? Because he's definitely not on the same path he was back in April.
No, and that definitely hurts. All right, my 27 is Chris Brooks, who I know you don't have on your list.
All right, so tell me about Mr. Square.
So part of it was I thought he had to be above Kyle Fletcher, honestly. Just because Kyle had a really big year for him, like kind of breaking onto the scene. But Chris Brooks, like similarly working in the same company as being kind of around and all that, Chris Brooks had like a breakout star year for him.
Yeah.
He starts out the year delivering really, you know, in the same vein that he has been for years, really good tag, intergender kind of stuff, stuff with Nixon on her way out of the indies. You know, different tag team matches with Lycos, all that. And you know, he looks good. And last year, I really think he kind of suffered in a lot of ways because he focused. He seemed to be, and we talked about this, I think, last year with the rankings on like Pete Dunne, where Pete Dunne had felt like the year before he had kind of spent a year learning how to be a star, and then last year he really executed. It felt like the same thing with Chris. I feel like last year Chris was focusing on how to really learn how to be a star, work a match that's not necessarily as intricate. I think people forget just how good of a technical wrestler he is because I hear people talk about him being shitty in ring, and it's like, well, he's not shitty in
that's
ring.
Yeah, that's not true at all. That's not true.
Yeah, he's just working a totally different style now that's a lot more, I think, broad to fan bases to get into. He's trying to really work essentially more like a WWF Attitude Era brawling style that gets over because he is a fucking phenomenal grappling wrestler, which he does get a chance to show this year. I feel like last year he put that together. He was putting together this really awesome feud with Clint Margera. He was kind of putting together working this brawling style that more of the fan base can get into. He's putting together this swag, this character. And then somewhere in the middle of the year, it just clicks. It feels like it starts out with they kind of show up in RPW, and you're thinking, okay. I mean, this is after he's already had months and a few months of just having really good matches that feel on the level of what he's been doing for a few years, you know, nothing crazy. So they show up in RPW, they start wrestling, they're having good matches, they feel like there's a groundswell of support, and they probably got to get the titles on them. But they don't, so instead they, or I guess they don't get the titles on them super quickly. And then out of nowhere they show up in WXW, and you're like, what the fuck? Or he shows up in WXW without Kid Lykos. It's him and Travis Banks. And from there, you know, they get the titles in. They got the WXW titles for like a minute, right?
No, they never won the WXW titles. They came in for a one shot against A4 and had a really damn good match, though.
Yeah, they had that fantastic match, and then they, and then eventually they do win the RPW tag titles, Rev Pro, I guess. And from there, they become, like I talked about, Eddie Dennis being kind of the workhorse mid card star of cockpit shows. CCK become the top level draw kind of stars of the cockpit shows.
Yeah, but it was very weird to watch happen that CCK kind of became like the actual top stars on the show. When you watch the York Hall shows, obviously the RF Pros going all out and bringing in Skrulls and Rey Mysterios and whatnot. But CCK and specifically Chris Brooks were really carrying those cockpit shows throughout the whole year.
Yeah, they were the shit. They were the stars. The crowds fucking loved them. Obviously the Dream Tag Team Invitational that's been brought up a couple times. They have phenomenal matches in that. They're doing stuff in Lucha Forever. Doing stuff, I say. They win the CZW Tag Team titles in Lucha Forever in a great match against Scarlett and Graves, which is a team that I just absolutely adore. And yeah, so then from there, I mean, you know, they win and lose the tag titles, all day. In this setting, in the, like I said, in the cockpit where he's becoming a big time star for Rev Pro, he ends up getting himself booked in a way where he's becoming like a championship level contender, and he has a one off title shot against Zack Sabre Jr., and that's where he gets to show his grappling skills and how he's just as good at grappling as Zack. And they have a really good match that I've heard a lot of people shit on that I actually enjoyed. I wouldn't probably have it in my top 20 matches of the year, but it was really good, and it was one of the better Zack Sabre Jr. defenses of the year comparatively, because I thought that Zack's title run has been not great in Rev Pro, or his tag team title, or his title run in Rev Pro was not great and before it ended. They go through, drop the titles to Aussie Open. He drops the titles to Aussie Open and wins the world title over in Fight Club Pro. And it's like, it's great because it's the first defense for Travis Banks, and it's a match that gets switched into a six way instead of a
quasi six man tag. And then towards the end, Chris Brooks was like, "Yeah, I want this title." And then him and Lykos turned on Travis Banks.
Yeah, so it was like, I think it was supposed to be a six-man tag, then it got turned into a six-way, but they were still acting like it was a six-man tag until the end when he's like, fuck it, I'm going to win the belt, and then he wins the belt, turning on Chris Brooks, or Travis Banks, who's been like his buddy all year. He wins the belt there, and of course it's perfect because Travis Banks, zero defenses. As we talked about progress not understanding how it works. Like, mm-hmm. that's how it works. The ultimate underdog, he wins the belt, and then he gets no defenses and
he gets shit on immediately.
Yes, by his best friend. You know what I mean? Like, it's just perfect. Trios tournament, I haven't watched all of it, but I've seen a little bit. He carries himself like a star there. I guess, for me, the reason why he makes the list and Lycos doesn't is because he had the tag stuff with Banks as well.
Right.
He had some good singles work that I really enjoyed. And I hate to say it, but you know, we talked about Lycos is underrated. That's because Chris Brooks stands out like a star.
Yeah.
Chris Brooks upped his game to feeling like a top level act in the UK and one of the hottest scenes in the world right now, and kind of is the UK scene in general. And I mean, he feels like he can be on par with anyone in all of the country as a top level guy that can main event any show. He can kind of win any big time title. He's helping to run the FCW shows now, and he's the champion. Like I said, they help make the Aussie Open feel like a big fucking deal when they get the win over them on their first tag team title match. Like, it's just all around. I just think he's shown that he's still got it when it comes to grappling. He's still got it in the ring. He's got this great charisma, this great character, and he also has become like a legit like high level star. And so that's just like, this is his breakout year, and I think he really deserves recognition for just how he kind of made himself into bigger than what he was before, just really by like sheer willpower. He just like kind of force of will made himself into a big fucking deal, and the crowd got into it, and it couldn't happen to a nicer guy, honestly. He deserves every bit of it, and at the same time, he's also comes across like the biggest fucking asshole on the planet because he's such a goddamn great heel. So I just kind of fell in love with him over the year, really impressed by what he was able to pull off. And I just think that he just continues running forward and becoming even bigger for the years to come.
I think Chris Brooks really is evidence that studying the game really does pay off. Just like I thought it was with Pete Dunne last year, where Chris Brooks, he was kind of like in the middle of the pack when it came to the UK scene as it was starting to bubble up. And he got some really cool gear. He became like the ultimate dickhead heel, spitting water and flipping off fans and doing all types of stuff and having a great Twitter game and just being an overall nice dude, having great looking merch. And it just turned into this overall package of CCK that took off like wildfire. I do think that he gets less credit than he deserves in the ring, even though I didn't have him. But he does. He has a lot of very good matches that border on great, especially that Zack Sabre Jr. match. I like the Ada match from Project Mayhem a lot. So it's not like he doesn't have the singles matches to boast, and he also does have the matches with two tag team partners to make his case, too. Not dissimilar to the case someone like Walter would have, having matches with Axel Leader Jr., as his partner, and also Timothy Thatcher. So I can definitely see why you have Chris Brooks on your list, and also so high for such a banner year for the guy. All right, to go into my 26, you watch NXT, so there's a chance you have this person, but my number 26 is Asuka.
She almost made my list. She ended up at 58. Just below Yearn Simmons, actually. So thought she was good, but I think that she got a little stale and derivative towards the end. But that said, she was always over. The crowd was always into her. I honestly felt like there was a mixture of she was only giving so much and she was also not being used to the full of her potential. But let me hear about why you got her at 26 here.
It's something that I've been hammering home this year when it came to Asuka, and even last year in 2016 when people were kind of, I think, undervaluing the story being told in the women's division in NXT, is that Asuka came in 2015 as this big, dominant force that nobody could touch, that people were afraid of. Early 2016, she destroys Bayley. August 2016, Bayley stands up to her, but she still gets put down. Now we get into 2017, and people aren't afraid of Asuka anymore. Now Asuka has to look over her shoulder because there are people that are gunning for her now, and not just cowering in the corner whenever she walks by. You have Billie Kay and Peyton Royce. You have Nikki Cross. You have Ember Moon. You have Ruby Riott, all gunning for title shots. And I think that's when we saw a different Asuka, because now it wasn't just this valiant, hard-fighting babyface champ who leans sometimes in the tweener or heel, depending on who she's facing. Now you have this person that is backed into a corner and has to just fight and scratch and claw and will do anything it takes to win. She isn't just going to win with a submission or a knockout now. She wants to win through any means necessary. She wants to keep her belt. And I thought that was most evident in the Orlando title match against Ember Moon that I thought was absolutely fantastic. Second best match on that show. Really like the maybe fourth or fifth best match of that whole weekend, honestly. The triple threat match against Ruby Riott and Nikki Cross was really well booked. And another case of Asuka pulling a win out of thin air to hold on to her title. The four-way title defense was really good. The last woman standing match against Nikki Cross showed a different side of Asuka. Showed she could thrive in WWE gimmick match style. The rematch of Ember Moon in Brooklyn I thought was even better than the first one. And I thought Asuka really was a big part in getting Ember Moon over as to where the first almost year of having Ember Moon at NXT, there was nothing to attach to with her. There was no great match. There was no personality. There was nothing to really care about with Ember Moon. And then working with Asuka really took Ember to that next level. I really wish that they didn't kind of botch Asuka going up to the main roster by having her go 50-50 with Emma. It seems that they're getting back in the right path since Emma's been released, oddly enough, and having her go through with squash matches and look like the most dominant person on the roster. But I don't know. That's just the main roster, and they always seem to fumble things when it's right in their hands, and they have a blueprint of how it will work. But yeah, I think for the story arc that was told throughout the last 2 years, I thought it wrapped up pretty well, even if she never wound up officially dropping the title to somebody.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely see the case for her, and I get where you're coming from. I thought that there was a few times there where definitely like her matches were the best matches on the NXT shows, but it was a down period for NXT overall. I felt that she definitely had some really great feuds. And in fact, there's actually someone who makes it on my list kind of based on working with Asuka in some ways. But yeah, I just think that I think her promo game lacked. I think they did a good job with the vignettes and stuff to kind of cover for that. But realistically, she just wasn't there for me. She also does disappear going up to the main roster for me. Unfortunately, I don't continue watching that. But from what I heard, she's kind of botched on her way up and is barely now kind of coming back from that. And I do think that they should have done something else with her for the title. I mean, they really shouldn't have just dropped the title that way or had her not drop the title that way, because it kind of, I think it hurt, especially with the new champion being Ember Moon. I think it really did hurt the women's title that was in a good place. But when you brought her up, you mentioned that I watch NXT, so maybe she'll end up on my list. You watch NXT too. I doubt this person's on your list, but we'll see. It's possible. My number 25, right? Is that what it should be doing? No. My 26. Number 26 is not from NXT. He is Joey Janela. Do you have Joey Janela on your list?
I had Joey Janela at 38.
At 38. Okay, so Joey. Just a fucking wild man. I believe every single thing that he does. He's simultaneously a complete fucking loose cannon and someone who you totally like can respect on social media, which is really fucking cool. It's like he'll just says whatever the fuck he wants, but you also don't see him doing anything super like rapey or shitty, which is just great because the character plays into the real guy and it just makes you believe in the real guy even more. You know, his first match of the year was a match I was at live. It was a really, really fucking good three-way match with him, Leo Rush, and Douglas James at PCW. He fucking was amazing in that match as the glue holding the whole thing together. People would probably think that Leo Rush stands out for all these flips and all that, but Joey Janela to me really showed his ring generalship in that match, being able to control and keep the match in line. Making stuff make sense, just like phenomenal worker. From there, he had a match in C4 that I actually did watch. It was his next match with the Marthu St. Jacobs, who's I think he's a member of the Tabernacle team guys, that I enjoyed, but obviously was not super, super great. But from there, beyond matches, I mean, the stuff with David Starr in the death match, showing up unannounced, continuing, if you talk about his beyond work, when he shows up straight from the hospital, tag matches, teaming with his girlfriend, I think maybe still girlfriend, Penelope Ford, the Janelope team becomes like a, like the kind of Sid and Nancy version of the world's cutest tag team with this fucking just almost seemingly drug-addled renegade and this like ex high school gymnast who he's just completely corrupted, and it's fucking amazing. Yeah, the guy is just insane. CCW kills it every time because he just bleeds black and yellow through and through. Always gives 110% in wild ass fucking crazy matches. Stuff in, yeah, all over the place, realistically. The guy is just always Joey Janela having these fucking just nutty matches. I mean, mixture of high spots and gimmicks and blood and innovative insane chair bumps and huge ladder bumps off the ceiling. And
he'll
and then, like,
a Swanton Bomb literally to the apron. Like,
Swanton Bomb into the backs of chairs all lined up together. And, like, yeah, the guy is just, he's a fucking nutbag. He kills himself for all of our enjoyment. And he, but then he can, like, turn around and FIP world title match against Fred Yehi that's, like, you know, not completely insane, but, like, really good match. And, yeah, the guy is just kind of the, he was kind of the king of the tournaments this year. He showed up in almost every big important tournament, I guess, even Bola shows up in SCI.
I was going to mention, like, his PWG stuff is that when they first announced him as the replacement for TK Cooper, who dislocated his ankle, I wasn't sure how Joey Janela would take. And then, lo and behold, I watched Bola, and I thought Joey Janela was probably the breakout star of the tournament.
Yep.
And not only the that, when you look at the All-Star Weekend previews, I'm not sure if you were at either of those shows, but I watched him versus Marty Scurll in the previews and whoever else he faced that weekend, and I'm like, holy shit. Joey Janela might really catch on to PWG.
No, he already has. People were talking about him as the breakout star of the weekend for Bola, like the entire time after his first match with Sammy. People just will not shut up about how much they love him. He's a guy who I think the crowd there was really wanting. They were like dying to have him in PWG for a long time already. So when he finally showed up, it was a big fucking deal. He carries an aura. He's bigger. He's really bigger than any company that he's in. He's instantly like the biggest star in most companies when he shows up, just because his name precedes himself. And it kind of, it's weirdly all off of the back of letting Zandig almost kill him off of the roof of a building, which is like super impressive. But, plenty of fucking guys have gone to CZW or have gone to Game Changer or have gone to all these other places and let some fucking asshole take liberties or do some crazy spot with them, and then their names have become nothing. But Joey Janela actually was able to leverage that and make it into a big-time character that got over huge, and he's become one of the top stars in the indies. I mean, fuck, he just had articles written about him in, like, Rolling Stone website and stuff. People are taking notice of this guy being just, like, a big fucking star. So, yeah, going forward, I mean, essentially indie wrestling is his oyster at this point, as right now it seems like wherever he wants to go, he can kind of write his ticket. I mean, he throws his spring break show and it becomes the talk of WrestleMania weekend. Any match that he has really just ends up being instant kind of gif fodder and talked about and just speculated on what's he going to do next. And it's super impressive how this guy has really kind of, he's used the multimedia of pro wrestling in 2017 to leverage probably the biggest, buzziest career that's going on right now.
You know, like, Joey and PWG kind of remind me of, like, when Drake and Cal Ann first came in. But he also just has a way bigger personality than either of those guys. So even if he's not bringing the same kind of nuttiness that those guys were doing, I think Joey brings a much bigger personality combined with the insane bumps that just makes him stand out in an environment like that. And he's already been killing it everywhere else. CZW, GCW, showing up in SCI. Beyond, he's about to have an Fans Bring the Weapons match against David Starr. Literally, like the first hour into 2018. So we'll see how that goes. But everywhere this guy goes, he just winds up becoming one of the most talked about names in the promotion. And I think if he can turn that into being one of the absolute top guys in the PWG in 2018, while still being one of the top flight names in every other indie that he works, we'll be talking about having Joey Janela hire next year.
Yeah, for sure.
And that was your 26, right?
Yeah, that was my number 26.
All right. My number 25 is Masaaki Mochizuki.
No Dragon Gate on my list this year, so that's all you.
Second half of the year, after the unit survival thing wrapped up, Masaaki Mochizuki just kind of took Dragon Gate by the horns and had awesome fucking singles matches. I thought he was good in every single multi-man match he was in, whether it was tag matches, trios matches, eight-man tags, whatever. Mochizuki is always really good in them and always one of the best parts. But Mochizuki, when he has something to sink his teeth into, is a completely different animal. Awesome match with Shingo Takagi on the opening night of King of Gate. Awesome singles match against Big R Shimizu that is probably a lot of people's Dragon Gate match of the year. Great, great, great title win against Yamato that was long overdue in the fact that Yamato's reign should have ended a while ago, in that Mochi wasn't exactly my first pick to be the one to beat him, but I'm not complaining about it since it's led to some really awesome matches. And just recently, he had a great match against Destiny against Jimmy Susumu that kind of felt like the old ROH style title defense with some Counter-Strike limb targeting from both guys, hard hitting, great counters, all that stuff. Mochizuki at almost 50 years old, still one of the absolute best wrestlers on the planet when it comes to being in a high spot. I'm not sure there's been that many title match workers in the world better than Masaaki Mochizuki this year. And if they have been, and if there have been better title match workers, they're higher on my list. So that's the case of Masaaki Mochizuki, 47 years old and still one of the absolute best on the planet.
Yeah, I mean, that's a solid kind of argument, and as he continues on with his age and level of talent, he does start to get into that conversation, greatest wrestler ever, greatest kind of senior wrestler ever. He's probably one of the top dads. The only reason why he gets overlooked as being such a top dad is that you can almost not tell that he's a like older dude. He wrestles just about as young as everyone around him, honestly. You can't even tell how old he is. So yeah, my 25 is who I was kind of leading into when I talked about NXT. There's a chance you have him longer or higher. My number 25 is Oney Lorcan, the former Biff Busick.
Oney did not make my list this year, and if I have to be honest, I wasn't really in love with his TV stuff as much as everyone was this year.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's what makes his case, obviously. He is just, I think, hands down, probably the best worker in all of NXT and probably all of WWE, based solely on what I've seen from him working in NXT. Every time he gets the chance, he knocks it out of the fucking park. He is the star of sub-5-minute matches, basically. Just the guy is just a fucking murderer. Facials are always on point. Just insane high-speed action. You buy into everything he does. I've talked about him endlessly on NXT, or when I review NXT, how he's like one of the few guys I've ever seen who he gets guys over not by just selling for them, but also by his own offense looks so good that it makes other guys look better if they're able to withstand it, which is fucking impressive. He gets other guys over by them being able to just take his amazing looking offense, which is so fucking cool. The guy is just something special, and they just need to focus on him a little bit more. But yeah, I mean, he essentially has had like less than 15 televised matches in 2017, and every single one of them was pretty much flawless. Just fucking amazing stuff. So yeah, the guy is just, I can totally see not having him. It's almost kind of indulgent, I guess, to have him because he has done very little in the year, but he is just too goddamn good to be denied. And yeah, so I just couldn't overlook him.
I think he is definitely the best case of someone not getting too many chances, but maximizing every single second they got of screen time. Against Hideo Itami, against Lars Sullivan, against Drew McIntyre, didn't matter.
Which some people have as like their match of the year, which is insane.
Teaming with Martin Stone. You know, whatever bit of screen time he's given, he always makes the most of it, and I'm never going to knock the guy for that. But for me, I'm just not a big fan of TV wrestling right now. And because of that, I guess sort of a block with that style of wrestling in my mind right now, that even if I really enjoy what Oni's doing, I really love the Hideo stuff, by the way. Like, people went crazy over the Drew McIntyre match, and that match is awesome, but I love that whole Hideo stuff. But because I'm just not super into TV-style wrestling right now, and Oni's sort of the king of that, that he's just not going to be represented well on my list.
Yeah, and that's completely fair.
All right, so my number 24, someone you just mentioned that you don't have on your list, but it's Kushida.
Yeah, no Kushida for me. And, I mean, that's probably unfair, honestly. He probably deserves to be on the list, but, again, there was just so much garbage in the Best of the Super Juniors that I essentially, as I was going through my list, I just waved my hands at putting any New Japan Junior on the list at all.
Other than the Hiromu stuff, I do think he's probably the best guy in the Best of the Super Juniors. I thought his match with Despy on the opening night was really damn good.
I actually think Desperado was the best guy in the Best of the Super Juniors, honestly. But so I would give that credit to Desperado instead of Kushida, which I know is insane.
I really loved his Taguchi match. But those two always have great matches together. I think what really puts it together for me is that I really, really love that Best of Super Juniors final against Ospreay. That felt like a really good follow-up to everything else they've done in New Japan. And even if I thought that was a better performance by Ospreay, Kushida is still right there with them, busting out new spots, new counters, being the vicious little technical guy that he is. I really love the title switch against Ospreay at King of Pro Wrestling. But yeah, I just love everything Kushida has done when he gets the chance to. The New Japan Juniors always suffer as the year goes on because either they'll be stuck in title defenses that I'm really not too sure of, or multi-man tag matches or whatever. It happened to Kushida last year because he was top five for me at one point before dropping the title. And maybe if he held the title throughout the year, this year he might be higher. But the whole thing with Hiromu and Kushida and going back and forth, and now with the junior title where it is now, just in general, all those guys have to fall down a little bit for me, other than people who were actually going out and like working at other places. And it's not to say Kushida didn't work at other places. Obviously working in What Culture, doing shots in ROH, appearing a couple times in CMLL, but wasn't enough for me to justify putting him higher.
Great Rev Pro match with Zack Sabre Jr.
Yes, yeah, I forgot to mention that. That was really good.
That was a great match. So, I mean, he had his stuff. He's a guy that I think if New Japan was just, I guess, I mean, he's completely signed with New Japan, but if he had a little bit more laxed contract or with New Japan or appearances and all that, he could be a guy who would show up in a lot of super indies, including PWG and stuff, and really, I think, be able to be a big-time indie breakout star, because I think part of the problem, yeah, is that New Japan just doesn't give him a chance. But his ROH television title run was actually pretty good. It was definitely better than Ishii's ROH TV title run.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just didn't do it for me. So my 24 is a guy who I think there's probably no chance that you have. It's Kane Justice. Oh, actually, no, you did have him. You just had him lower.
Yeah, I had Kane Justice at my 50.
Okay, Kane Justice at 50. So he's 24 from our... Is he 24? Yeah, he's 24 for me. Because I felt like he really was just like in that top 25 range. Like just barely inching his way into the top 25 range this year. The guy, I mean, his work speaks for itself. He is kind of a virtuoso in the ring, honestly. Every little heel mannerism and detail that he adds in, he's only just now starting to slightly kind of get the fans behind him as a babyface, especially in the Rumble, in the CWF Rumble when he was in the final stretch with Trevor. The fans were definitely getting behind him. And it almost felt like it was meant to be that way. So it's really impressive because he's done a great job of keeping the crowd 100% heel against him. He hasn't had a single match that I didn't think was fantastic this year. And I've watched all of them, essentially. He needs to get out of CWF and have more matches in other places. But realistically, every single match in ring is great. But what gets him this high on the list is his promo work, his character work, his look, his commentary work, his everything about this guy just oozes this fucking shitty character that you just fucking hate. And he's a rookie. He's under 3 years experience. That's how he's RGL champion. And he's having heavyweight title matches against Jade. He's going toe-to-toe with Trevor Lee to finish out the Rumble. He's in the six-pack challenge for the title. I mean, he just feels like he should be at that top level already, and he's brand fucking new. He has the poise of a 10-15-year vet. He carries himself like a star. He is amazingly great at showing ass, fighting off the back foot, coming across like a fucking chicken shit heel while also being like really, really amazingly talented as a pro wrestler. Just the guy has everything you could ever want in a wrestler. And at his age, it's super impressive the way he shows that off. His feud with Dirty Daddy really took Dirty Daddy from being what felt like a comedy character to being Dirty Daddy being just on his level as a guy who you can start seeing in the mix in the mid-card title range. His feud with retired wrestler Cecil Scott obviously shows just how good he is, that he got Cecil Scott impressed that he wanted to come out of retirement to wrestle against him. And the feud was a lot of really great mic work, ending up with just like one match against against a retired guy that super delivers. Goes from there into a big time feud with Mitch Connor, who's another veteran, and he holds his own every step of the way with this vet that doesn't outshine him in any way. I mean, it's impossible to me. I think that the only reason why Kane Justice isn't on everybody's list is because they're just not watching CWF. They're not keeping up on CWF as much. Because, I mean, realistically, the guy is easily one of the top 100 wrestlers, top 50 wrestlers. He's one of the best wrestlers going right now. And I don't think that there's any argument against him, honestly, for just how good he really is.
I think you hit the nail on the head is that him being so young into his career and that he feels like so natural filling in a CWF title match is kind of insane. But think about the fact that he's going back and forth between like working RGL shows and working RGL matches and wrestling Dirty Daddy and guys who are in similar, who have similar experience levels to him. Guys like Dominic Guarini, who I'm pretty sure Kane Justice has been wrestling longer than him. And he can wrestle those guys and have great matches with them and then look like he's Trevor Lee's equal. Like, that is kind of insane for a guy that's 20 years old. But yeah, if I watch more CWF TV, then Kane would be higher. But I've loved every single thing I've seen from him this year. I wish he'd pop up in places like maybe a Nova Pro, a Sup Graps, a Black Label. Places where guys like that will get a chance. But he's still young. He still has a lot of time to grow and figure things out. But yeah, I think the sky's the limit for Kane Justice. All right. And that was 24, right?
24, yeah.
All right. So my number 23, I know you don't have since you have no Dragon Gate guys. But my number 23 is Takahiro Yamamura.
Yeah, not on my list.
This is really going to come from the standpoint of what it means as a Dragon Gate fan for a guy to have a year like this. In a year in Dragon Gate where there was so much uncertainty, Yoshino getting hurt early in the year and people not knowing how severe it was, Kotoka getting hurt, Kaito Ishida getting hurt, his tag team partner, and everything in general just being in a real state of flux. Takahiro Yamamura stepped up to the plate and became probably the best guy in the company in 2017. Whether it was these big, crazy eight-man tag main events at Korakuen Hall, facing Big Arshimizu, great King of Gate run facing Shima, Doi, and Kagetora as far as the stuff that made it online, a Brave Gate title challenge against Kagetora. Just everywhere the guy showed up, I felt like he was the shining light of what was a very down half to Dragon Gate 2017. As Dragon Gate as a whole started to get better later in the year, Takahiro Yamamura's, importance kind of dwindled down. But that doesn't change the fact that in my favorite promotion, in what was really a time where no one knew what to expect or what to believe in, that Takahiro Yamamura gave Dragon Gate fans something to latch on to. And it wasn't just in emotion, it wasn't just in story, and wanting to see this young guy succeed who had never really been put in positions like this before. He was going out there and delivering in great matches, night in and night out, against T-Hawk and against all these other guys. So, for that, Takahiro Yamamura has to make my list, and was initially slotted higher, but when I looked at my list, I had to move him down a few slots because certain guys, I think, had a more widespread impact, and Yamamura's only felt for about 5 or 6 months of the year.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place Simulations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com. And we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows plus others available on PlacementNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacementNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlacementNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Yeah, and I think that once I, if I ever go back and revisit 2017 Dragon Gate, he'll probably end up somewhere in my list as well. But unfortunately, I completely gave up on Dragon Gate, I think, in like May or April. So yeah, I just I am like dangerously behind on it. To really put anybody from Dragon Gate on my list would have been unfair, I think. Even though there was some stuff that I really liked. So my number 23, I think you might have on your list. I don't know, actually, because I don't know how much you've been into DDT, but Kinosuke Takeshita is my number 23.
I have Takeshita higher.
Okay.
All right, so my number 22, someone I'm not sure about where you stand on them this year. But my number 22 is Shuji Ishikawa.
Shuji is... what the fuck? Okay, yeah, he is. He's higher for me.
All right, so you're 22.
My 22, see, I don't... if you had Kinosuke higher, you have to have Daisuke Sasaki higher.
I don't have Sasaki.
What the fuck?
I haven't been watching that much of DBZ.
Okay,
I've actually been meaning to do a catch-up.
Sasaki, to me... was, that's why I have him just above. I think he was really better than Takeshita this year. It feels weird for me to not get to talk about them back to back like I had planned to, honestly. But I mean, you turn around and like, I think that his match with Hiroshima was better. I think that his extreme title run was better in a lot of ways than Takeshita's open weight title was. I felt like he had a lot more charisma. He kind of elevated the title. He took the title and made it into a big deal. I felt like the Iron Man match with Dick Togo was like fucking amazing and realistically better than anything that Takeshita did all year. Loved him in the King of DDT tournament against Akio. I thought that match was fantastic. I think that he showed a depth of skill that a lot of other people don't have. Being able to be this really fantastic comedy worker, plays up this kind of weird crush on Candice LeRae, but then can also be super serious and a fantastic mat worker with matches that make super great psychology sense, oozes charisma, big, like, even when they want Endo, who's got the look, he's got everything, the flashy high flying to be the kind of the star of Damnation. I think, Sasaki really easily comes out as being the bigger star. Just naturally the crowd loves him. Fantastic kind of shitty look. He's a guy that I think before Damnation formed, I always thought that he had kind of this weird look that would leave him at like indie scum level for his entire life. But somehow mixing that up with Damnation, it makes it make sense in a way that he actually comes across like a star level performer. Great tag team matches with Damnation. With Mad Polly primarily actually having some great matches there. Mad Polly, another guy who I got an appreciation of this year that I didn't have, but did not end up making my list, unfortunately. Loved the three-way title match with him and Takeshita and Ken Oka. Thought that, you know, he's able to play off the serious and the comedy. He bridges that gap, I think, better than anybody since Ibushi and Kenny Omega stopped being realistically the top guys of the company. I think realistically you need a guy who's able to work kind of comedy and serious in DDT. It's a really important part of the company. And I think actually he's turning the Extreme title with himself as being that guy and more of the ace of the company than Takeshita was, even if he's not being pushed properly. Obviously, like I said, Damnation becomes the most popular group. I think that's built on the back of him being one of the most popular wrestlers in the whole company. So yeah, it's like, that's kind of my breakdown of Sasaki. I just think, a big part of it is he's got that Daniel Bryan thing. He's over way higher than his push level would like kind of tell you that he should be. And it just comes down to that he's fucking amazing. Great match with Diego just a little bit ago last month that was really impressive because Diego's a guy who I liked in DNA but never saw much of him, but he was able to have a match where Diego came across pretty serious and was a really, really good match. So, yeah, I just think he shows that he can go from working with a vet, working with a rookie, working comedy, working with a woman, working with whatever it is, he can make it work. And you know, above him, you're supposed to have Takeshita, who's supposed to be in that ace role, and I feel like Takeshita is losing overness and does not have that same level of connection with the crowd of being able to work any part of the card, which is really important in DDT overall.
Oh, yeah, there's no case against Sasaki other than the fact I just haven't seen much of his stuff other than the Togo match, which is excellent. So when I get around to doing a big catch up on DDT, like I plan to, then Sasaki will probably show up a few times on my, top 100 matches of 2017 list.
All right.
Now onto another guy that I know you have higher than me at 21. I have Jeff Cobb.
Oh yeah. You know, I have Jeff Cobb higher.
Right.
So my 21 is the ace, Eric Royal.
I wasn't able to squeeze Eric Royal on this year.
Well, not okay. I can't blame you. Great stuff in Nova Pro, obviously. He's kind of the star of Nova Pro for the upper mid card, undefeated kind of thing, but never doesn't really. He main events sometimes, but he's not always like the preeminent main eventer. But really good match with Fred Yehi to start out the year. good stuff in the Commonwealth Cup, finally dropping his first loss to Logan Easton LaRue, helping make Logan feel like a big star. Great match with Sugar Dunkerton. Really loved the four-way with Trip Cassidy and Alexander James. Yeah, just the guy is, you know, gets the rematch with Logan, beats him there in Nova Project 3 in a big-time main event with wild, crazy crowd brawling as this lovable babyface that everyone gets into big time. The crowd loves him, and then they're, like, so into him, and they're going crazy and all this stuff, and it's like really impressive because he could turn around and have a match that's like a very, very similar match in a very similar kind of area. You know, you go from Virginia to North Carolina, but he's in Chapel Hill with a match against Snooty Fox and CWF, and it's like the complete opposite crowd reaction. They're like ready to riot when he fucks over Snooty Fox to get the win. And then that's where his real case is made, is 100%, not 100%, but very largely in CWF. His Nova Pro stuff is really good. I really recommend it, but I mean, the lion's share of his work is in CWF, where he is just like hands down the best fucking heel. He might actually be the best heel in wrestling. Just pure straight up fucking heel shit. Fucks with everybody in the crowd. No matter what, he like, I think he gets great pleasure out of making sure that he legitimately fucks with every single person in the crowd, like specifically, individually. He goes out of his way to make sure that he pisses off every person before he leaves. It's just phenomenal how good he is at that. And you just buy into him. Some of his little snide comments when he's not even supposed to be the focus, which you could almost, I could see other people digging into it as a negative thing because he draws attention away, but I fucking love it. Someone else will be cutting a promo and he'll just be in the background spouting off, saying some stupid shit and just kind of wiling out like a fucking asshole. And it's just like stealing all of your attention just to pay attention to this guy. In ring, he works like just the big time monster, carries himself like he's undefeatable, but always is able to essentially show ass and lose when necessary. Really underrated, I think, is his stooging, which is always like comedy and stooging and stuff like that is something I bring up that I think a lot of purists who I kind of interact with, you can read that as Pete Schumacher from This Week in Wrestling, don't necessarily appreciate as much as I do. But I think that it's actually a big part of wrestling as well to be able to show that you can do that, that you can bump, feed, stooge, do some comedy work, do some serious work, and he really can. It's really impressive that you can kind of get into his comedy stuff, really buy into it, but when it's time to turn it on and be serious, he fucking kills it. His tag team with Roy Wilkins this year in the All-Stars has been really, really great. They were in the Coup Noodle Cup, and they had a lot of fantastic matches. Every time they team up, you get really into it. Phenomenal psychology with him being the Wrecking Ball Monster and Wilkins being the kind of the finesse and the technical work guy. Turns around, shows up in Scenic City Invitational. Great match against Dominic Guarini to open up, a guy who ended up on my list as well. Just really, really loved that match. It's the mix of the big monster power guy against the grappler. And you just, it's again to show off Eric Royal's kind of his ability to really mix everything into in different settings. He can work different people, different styles. After that match, he goes on to take on Kurt Stallion, does a phenomenal job of helping put over Kurt Stallion, make him look like $1 million going forward into the tournament. But yeah, the guy just so good. CWF Mid-Atlantic title match against Trevor Lee. Flips the switch and, like I said, goes from comedy joking around to the Stone Cold Killer serious, wants to get his title back from this young punk. Truthfully, probably the most criminally underappreciated wrestler on the planet Earth right now. A guy who deserves to be booked in every fucking company in the country, in the world, and just doesn't get that appreciation that he deserves because, unfortunately, he doesn't get out of his region very much. But clearly, just, I mean, he's one of the greatest wrestlers, I think, of modern era, of modern time. In pretty much every way, he, like I said, bumping, selling, seriousness, heel, comedy, everything you can imagine. The guy is just like all that and more.
And I had Eric Royal on my list last year. I had consumed much more Nova Pro and CWF last year than I have this year. So that's just what it comes down to there. But everything you said there sounds up to par with what Eric Royal has been in my time watching him. I always liked him as a babyface. But this new heel work and everything he's been doing for the last year is just, like, perfect for him. Coming out and being the most obnoxious, arrogant, in-your-face motherfucker there is on the wrestling scene is great, especially for a very intimate setting like CWF. So I would have Eric Royal if I had just seen more of CWF in Nova Pro. But because I just haven't seen much of that stuff, that Eric Royal sadly misses my list. All right, and time to get to my number 20. And my number 20 is probably going to surprise some people for how high I have her. Probably wouldn't make a lot of people's lists, honestly. But my number 20 is Kaylee Ray.
I wanted to have Kaylee Ray on my list so badly, but I just couldn't get her. So please talk about her for as much as she deserves, because I just couldn't get her on there this year, unfortunately.
Everything you said about Pete Dunne last year is like everything you could possibly say about Kaylee Ray. And she also has the fact that she can work babyface too. From being a really great, menacing, controlling heel, her great high-flying offense, she can be a great valiant babyface, great comedy wrestling, great tag team wrestling, great singles wrestling, any promotion she's in, whether it be Progress or ICW or Stardom or Southside or OTT, even in the little bit of Mae Young Classic stuff that I've seen, she always goes out there, and I always think that she just delivers. She is versatile as hell. She can be your, top female. She can be your champion. She can be your mid-card champion. She can be opening a show. She can be in a six-man tag. She can do anything you want her to because Kaylee Ray is that damn versatile. Truthfully, maybe the most versatile wrestler on the planet. I get it that maybe Kaylee Ray isn't having these outwardly spectacular matches on every show. But to me, there is something to be said about the person that whenever I see them and they're doing a different thing, and that I can get into it regardless of what it is. where they'd be having some kind of British rounds match revolving around drinking beer. Would it be wrestling a 17-year-old Millie McKenzie and really establishing the fact that Millie McKenzie is very good? Wrestling Nixon Newell on her way out. Wrestling Candice LeRae. I feel like just Kaylee Ray can do anything. She's a great promo. She has a great look. She just exudes a star presence, even when she's not in the main event, that I just absolutely adore. I really don't have enough good words to say about Kaylee Ray, other than the fact that if you're missing the fact that she's one of the best wrestlers in the world just because she's not exactly a main event player, then you're sorely missing out, because everything Kaylee Ray does to me is must watch.
Yeah, I mean, she had fantastic matches with Abby Laith. What was her name? What did her name used to be? Kimberly, I think.
Yeah.
The stuff with Martina, wrestling Martina and tagging with Martina. The stuff in Stardom, the very little that I saw was very good. Probably Toni Storm's best opponent, if we're being perfectly honest. Honestly, probably Alex Windsor's best opponent. Probably...
Other than Chris Brooks, probably Nixon Newell's best opponent.
Yeah, it's like, I'm trying to think, like Piper Niven, like almost... great match with Chris Wolf, who doesn't really, I'll just say it, doesn't really have great matches. I know she's really popular. I like her stuff, but I don't think that she's a great worker. But Kaylee Ray has a great match with her. You really hit the nail on the head there. She can work anyone. She can have great matches with anyone.
Oh, this is even like counting like her wrestling men too, in which she's right. One of the people like that it never feels out of place. She feels just as badass as the guys, where a lot of intergender can feel creepy and forced, and Kaylee Ray, it never feels that way. And that's a skill that not everybody has when working those kind of matches.
Yeah, that's for sure, too. I mean, she definitely is able to kind of bridge that gap really easily. You talk about comedy, shenanigans, serious wrestling, believable, just everything, essentially. She could do it all. I think you're right to have her this high. I think I'm actually wrong to not have her higher and not have her on my list at all. Unfortunately, she's not on my top 50. She'll definitely be making my top 100. But yeah, I mean, I am right there with you on all of this pretty much. And I think that I just, kind of oversighted it and didn't give her the respect that she deserves. Unfortunately.
One more thing before we move off of Kaylee Ray is that I'm saying all of this about her, and she's only 24 years old. Like,
right.
She has hopefully like another 10 years ahead of her of just being like this high level and this kind of versatile and having this kind of variety. And even if she does wind up going to WWE at some point, which I think it would be insane if she is never signed.
Yeah.
I think she has like the potential to be a breakout star if they ever go with a flat out all women show or have her on Raw or SmackDown. She just has that kind of quality to her where she just can't be denied, I think.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. Okay, so my number 20, and this is one that I really wonder because even though you hosted a Lucha podcast, I guess even my podcast has Lucha in it and I don't pay attention, right? My number 20 is Rey Fénix.
I had Fénix at 44.
Okay. A lot of what makes Fénix for me is that seeing him live enough really helped me to appreciate just how fucking amazing he is as a seller. Underdog babyface work is phenomenal. His crispness with his flying is amazing. His technical game shown off in his match with Zack Sabre Jr. was super impressive. He is a guy who is super versatile. His worst match of the year was against Will Ospreay. That match was garbage. Don't watch it. But he can go from wrestling essentially the kind of top flight super indie darlings. He can wrestle all the crazy luchadors. He can wrestle kind of extremo. I don't even know what they call it. Like hardcore wrestling in Mexico. He can be the number one best guy on a PWG show. He can wrestle in Europe and have amazing, crazy spot fest tag team matches. He could be the champion in AAW, have really good match with Josh Alexander just recently, who's another guy who I really wish could have be on my list somewhere, but unfortunately He got the travel ban and hasn't been going to Japan, so he's not getting the respect that I think he deserves. Great match against his brothers. Great match tagging with his brother. Phenomenal match against Rocky Romero and Bar Wrestling just recently. Or I guess not recently, but just a little while ago that I really, really enjoyed the live experience on that one. Like, the guy is just really fucking good. Matches with Travis Banks. Yeah, like I said, I just think he shows that he can work everything. His stuff in the Crash, stuff against the match in APW just recently against Juventud and Rey Mysterio, like kind of working dream match settings. He can do it all. He can work like kind of the dirtiest, grimiest fucking indie in Mexico. He can work the biggest, most polished show, any, you know, in the Cow Palace. The guy can versatilely work anywhere and stands out as like the most talented worker in on the card in the on the match in the show every time. I think he gets overlooked. His brother is a lot more charismatic, but I think in ring wise he's just a much better worker all in all.
In 2014, 2015, when Lucha Underground was first starting to get off the ground, Phoenix was definitely one of those guys that caught everybody by surprise. Not just for his sensational high flying, in which he does some athletic stuff that really nobody else can do. The first time I saw him do that kip up on the ropes, I absolutely lost my mind and had to immediately think, have I ever seen anybody do that? And I'm still not sure I have. But you hit the nail on the head, is that he's a great seller, and he's always been a great seller. The problem is that he just doesn't do that very often, honestly. And while I love that aspect of his game, and I think he's one of the absolute best at it when he gets the chance to, I'm not sure if you ever saw it, but from Ultima Lucha Trace, he had an awesome hair versus mask match against Marty DeMoth, where that was sort of a throwback to the Phoenix we got used to in Ultima Lucha, in Lucha Underground Season 1, facing Mil Muertes, just bleeding and selling and getting in hope spots. And that was a real throwback performance to the Phoenix that I love. And granted, I still love him when he does his tag matches with Pentagon. I think that Lucha Brothers tag team has given both of them more life than they would have otherwise, honestly. I'm not sure how his AEW title run is going to go, but I did really like his match in AEW with Trevor Lee. I thought his match with Trent and PWG was really good. Obviously, the DTTI stuff was really fun. But yeah, I really enjoy Phoenix. If he had did more of this babyface selling and more promotions, and it wasn't just as go-go-go as a lot of his stuff usually is, then I might have him higher, since that's the kind of Phoenix stuff I typically enjoy more. But we just didn't get more of that, so that's where he landed.
Sorry about that. Yeah, I think, like I said, a lot of it too is that for me, seeing him live really made me appreciate stuff more that I then watch on tape and have a bigger appreciation for watching back, just knowing how good everything looks in person. All right, so I guess that's your number 19.
All right, now my number 19 is AJ Styles.
Okay, now this was a tough one. I had AJ everywhere from number 3 to, like, number, I think, 20. And I just couldn't do it because it felt dishonest. Even though what I've seen of him I really liked, and I know that he's phenomenal, pun, I guess, intended there, I just couldn't do it, knowing that, like, I didn't really watch all of his matches. And even though I know that no one would bat an eye if they heard that I had, you know, AJ Styles in my top 20, they would just assume that that makes sense. But I know that it would be kind of dishonest for myself because I just didn't actually watch the matches. And yeah, so I just couldn't have him on my list, you know? And that's going to seem crazy to some people, but I just couldn't do it because I just don't watch enough WWE.
No, I totally get it. That's definitely a reason why someone like Eric Royal didn't make my list. Even though I think the world of the guy, if I haven't seen the stuff, even if I know it's probably good, I'm just not going to go in blind and just say, oh, he should be on my list anyway because he's Eric Royal. So AJ Styles, I think he has the two best matches that have happened on the main roster this year easily, with the Royal Rumble match with Cena and the Survivor Series match against Brock Lesnar. The big knock on him is that the Kevin Owens program that went on for a very long time just didn't produce great matches, surprisingly, because I think the world of both guys, they just don't click very well for whatever reason. But even just on regular TV, I thought AJ Styles was very good, usually. I thought he had the best matches Baron Corbin is probably ever going to have on those TV matches they had with each other. His performance in that Elimination Chamber where Bray Wyatt won the title was really damn good. Just every time I think AJ Styles actually gets something to sink his teeth into, he's always going to give you his best effort and never let you down. So I think having the best Brock Lesnar match since like 2013 is definitely a big feather in its cap here. Having the two best matches that happened on a WWE main roster year while I wasn't really in love with a lot of what they did definitely speaks to the fact that even on what could be called an off year for AJ Styles, he's still producing the best stuff to happen out of everybody on the main roster.
Yeah, and I mean, that's completely fair, and I think that the Brock Lesnar match, while I don't think I liked it as much as a lot of other people, I definitely see where people are coming from, especially when you put it into perspective. But I kind of turn around and I say, like, well, where is everybody else? Because I used to always kind of like say that the Punk Undertaker match deserved a lot more credit than it got because of what we learned later, that Undertaker was nowhere near that good. And it was a lot of hard work from Punk to get that out of him. But people kind of decided to take the match on face value. And I kind of feel the same way about the Brock match, if I'm perfectly honest. I'm like, on face value, there was a lot of sloppiness. There was some shitty botches. And there was some stuff that looked majorly dangerous. And like, even though AJ was able to make like Brock look better than he has looked, that doesn't make that stuff good. You know what I mean? So unfortunately, that was kind of where I came down on that. And then meanwhile, like, I thought that the Shane match was, while good, was like fucking tiresomely disgusting, overly pushed McMahon bullshit. And like realistically from there, I watched very little else. I thought that he had good matches with Reigns. I think I liked some of the Kevin Owens work better than other people, but that's also because I'm like unapologetically, I think, a lifetime Kevin Steen stan. I'm never going to not be a big time fanboy for him, I think. So that's probably part of why I like those matches more than other people. But yeah, so that said, my number 19, kind of going back to back, it's kind of funny, looking over the list and everything, I think he might actually be the person who had the most matches in 2017 that's on my list in general, the most matches that you can watch, I think, even for sure, maybe even the most matches that I've seen. My number 19, and I would be, I think you said him earlier, I hope, is Juice Robinson.
Yeah, I had Juice Robinson at 34.
Okay, so earlier I think you said Kyle Fletcher argument for best babyface in pro wrestling. I forgot and didn't really think about it, but Juice Robinson I think was the best babyface in 2017. And it's funny because in 2016 I really questioned a lot of his mannerisms, his loud cursing, his kind of shitty attitude and stuff like that as being like stuff that affected his babyface dump for me. But I think in 2017 he really kind of shored some of that stuff up, continued to do some of that stuff, but really delivered some amazing babyface performances. I thought the match at Wrestle Kingdom with Cody Rhodes was really fucking good. I think a lot of people weren't as high on it just because of it being Cody Rhodes, but I actually thought that it was a great match. I thought that most of his work in ROH this year was fucking phenomenal. I thought he had good matches with pretty much everyone. Hiroki Goto, he was always really good in the tag matches, always super over as one of the undercard guys in the tag matches. New Japan Cup, I thought he had a decent match with Yujiro, a fantastic match with Shibata. Again, like I said, you know, just really always stood out, lots of personality, crowd got behind him big time. Intercontinental title match with Naito, I think, was when you started to see maybe they're going to take him seriously. Big time match against a big time star, looked really good, believable, could win the match at some point, but never doesn't come out with the belt. And then from there, yeah, he's like, he gets kind of token title matches here and there. gets the United States Heavyweight Tournament in Long Beach, has a really, really great match with Zack Sabre Jr. that kind of, you know, at the time, Zack was on fire, but you're like, oh, this juice guy, I think this is it. And then you start the G1, and I think he was probably the star of the G1 night in and night out. I think other guys may have had higher highs, but I think nobody else delivered as consistently as him. He told a story throughout the entire tournament, continued to sell throughout the entire tournament, this big time story, really upped his stock, becomes almost a name coming out of it, a guy that you have to argue is just phenomenal. Goes into CMLL for a little bit after the G1's over. I saw very little of that, but what I did see obviously looked like he was doing pretty good. Match with Shocker that I thought was like shockingly good for a Shocker match, if we're being perfectly honest. I kind of got into that. United States Heavyweight title match with Kenny Omega, I think probably a lot of people's, could be people's match of the year. I thought really, really great work from both guys. Really cemented him as kind of a name for going on forward. Tag league stuff, from what I've heard, is very good. Unfortunately, I have not gone out of my way to watch any of his tag league matches because I don't like his partner even slightly. I don't care to see Sami Callihan at all. But yeah, that said, the guy is probably one of the best baby faces, best underdog sellers, best long term psychology sellers in the game. And really just completely makes his name based off of that. I loved him this year, and I think if New Japan gets serious about him, the crowd loves him enough that he could be a big star for the company moving forward.
I think with Juice that this was just a year where he just kept topping himself. He got the never title match with Goto, and you're like, oh man, this is the biggest match of Juice's career. He gets the Intercontinental title match against Naito. It's like, oh man, this is the biggest match of Juice's career. He gets the match against Kazuchika Okada in the G1, and you're like, oh man, biggest match of Juice's career. And you get the United States title shot, you're like, oh man, biggest match of Juice's career, where we always just kind of seem to think that Juice isn't going to get much bigger than this, but he just keeps going and going and going, and it just feels genuine in how he keeps expanding and growing as a wrestler. And it's just through being a genuinely likable, endearing, funny, easy to root for white meat babyface through selling, having a great punch, having great finishing stretches. You know, there's nothing to dislike about the guy. And I really enjoyed seeing how everybody in this Twitter bubble that we're in is all in on Juice Robinson. There's not that many people in the wrestling Twitter bubble that Pete does unanimously liked. And Juice Robinson is probably the guy that everybody can get behind, and nobody has a bad word to say about them, and that speaks volumes of his work. So to move on, my number 18 here is someone you might have hired since you haven't said his name yet, but I have Speedball Mike Bailey.
Yeah, I've got him a little bit higher. Right. So my number 18, if I recall, I think you probably already said, and if you haven't already said, then I can't imagine you don't have higher, is Tyler Bate.
Of Tyler Bate, actually, my next guy.
Oh, perfect. So I guess I'll talk about Tyler Bate. Best young guy in wrestling, I think, conversation we've had before that's really kind of weird to parse out, but is like, in some ways, just the case. Well-rounded, super talented, coming into his own charisma character-wise. I think there's no doubt he's got the best mom on Twitter. just A+, Jill Bate, number one, everyone. United States title tournament going in, or United Kingdom title tournament going in. Thought, oh, Bate will do okay, but clearly they care about Pete Dunne. Clearly Trent Seven is going to be a big deal, but I think, you know, just based on how he had been treated in the UK Indies up until that point, I didn't think much of it.
Let's be clear here that going into the UK tournament, Tyler Bate was very clearly the number three of British Strong Style.
Right. And I mean, an upper mid card, lower mid card guy in the UK in general.
Yeah.
I mean, they Mustache Mountain was and British Strong Style was all formed about fucking him over, you know, and getting the big stars together and all this. Like, so he was not, to me, he was not seen as a win. He was not even, to me, seen as a dark horse winner. I was like, there's no, he's not going to do much. He's going to be in here. I thought he was going to be kind of fodder for other guys. Then the brackets start to come out, and, you know, he goes against Tucker in a phenomenally great match. And you're like, well, he's going to get that win, and he does. Then from there, Wolfgang, and you think, well, I think they're pretty serious about pushing Wolfgang.
He faces Devlin after that. He faces Devlin.
Oh, Devlin. Okay, Devlin match was another one where it could have been.
And he always has great matches with Devlin, so you knew they were going to deliver there, but you didn't know who was going to win.
Yeah, and I think I probably would have given the nod to Devlin just because of the connection to Balor. I thought that, oh, they're going to, you know, get serious about this guy because he's their boy's boy or whatever. But, you know, he takes him out. Then, yeah, then the Wolfgang match feels like, okay, well, Wolfgang's got to go into the main event, you know, because they're going to take him seriously as the big deal ICW guy, and he can lose to Bate in the or to Dunn in the finals over some shenanigans or whatever, and it'll make sense. But, no, he gets the win on Wolfgang, and you're like, huh. Well, then going into the finals, you're still like, well, Dunn has to win it. But no, Bate gets the win. The crowd goes nuts. They love it. It's a long story arc told out throughout the entire tournament with his arm and the arm selling in the match and then powering up to be able to hit that big kind of rampage bomb. And then finally, after it's, you know, to finish it off with the Tyler Driver, gets the win. Feels like a big fucking deal. And then from there, continues on, working all over the place, great matches against, like, so many different opponents. Like you mentioned, Devlin tagging with Dunn, tagging with Seven. I'd say big time issues with the British Strong Style tag team matches, especially in Progress, start to get bloated and boring. Fight Club has some issues with that as well. But every time you get just Mustache Mountain or just Tyler Bate in a singles, you get big time deliveries. Fucking awesome matches every time. The guy just keeps getting slicker, better, faster, more talented. This guy just seems the sky's the limit. Like... Yeah, new spots you've never seen before. Really cool stuff. Then he turns around and has what's like another like very top match of the year match in against Pete Dunne at TakeOver Chicago, which I think, you know, a lot of people are going to have that as their match of the year. A lot of people have that as the standout match. I'm like, yeah, that match was really good, but like it wasn't. I wouldn't even say it was their best match of the year. Then they turn around and like a week later they have they do the match, but they switch gimmicks and you have Pete Dunne dressed up like Tyler Bate and Tyler Bate dressed up like Pete Dunne and they do a very similar.
Tyler Bate looking more like Pete Dunne than Pete Dunne does.
Yeah, and it's just, it's amazing that they like switch the match around and have like the same match but in reverse and you're just like, what the fuck? After the fantastic showing in the Super Strong Style. But I think we both expected him to end up winning. It was kind of funny after having the opposite feeling in the British or the UK title tournament of like, what the fuck? Why is he making it to the finals? This match, it felt like, oh, he's going to probably win this, even though Banks seemed like the clear winner. And you're like, I think that they might go with him. He loses and really puts over Banks strong in the end. Really, I couldn't think of another person other than Travis and Bate to be the finals to deliver that many great matches throughout the tournament because they both just had knockout matches every time.
In their history together, it just was like the natural last obstacle for Travis Banks to overcome.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think the Lucha Forever title match against Mark Haskins is like a low-level, under-the-radar match of the year candidate that a lot of people haven't taken the time, I think, to see. The match with Kyle Fletcher in Attack was another one where Kyle Fletcher looked amazing, and obviously a lot of that has to do with Bate. Tag team match, British Strong Style against War Machine. Another really good match, even though it's in Progress. It really was the only time that they were bad was the trios matches in Progress and Fight Club, and everything else was good. Singles match against Jeff Cobb in Fight Club Pro that just was knockout fucking amazing. Kid Like Us.
Yeah.
A fucking phenomenal. The guy is just, I mean, through and through. I mean,
oh, he didn't even great mention, match. We didn't even mention his stuff with Mark Andrews. Like, he had two awesome matches with Mark Andrews. One at the UK special and one at Progress Orlando over WrestleMania weekend.
Yeah, the Andrews matches always good. Actually, he had more than just those against Andrews this year, but those ones particularly stand out as fantastic. But yeah, because he also. Well, no, I guess that was it, but he had the title match and the Progress match. Both fantastic. Great matches with Mark Haskins. Yeah, the guy is just what, 20? 19?
20. Just 20
at this point. Just turned 20 right now. Been wrestling for 5 years already. Another one, I've said this a lot, I think, at this point, but sky's the limit. Probably going to end up being one of the best ever. I mean, realistically, with the trajectory that he's on, it's hard to argue that he's not going to just continue to impress and become one of the best. So, I mean, now that I've kind of taken up all the gushing, Quentin, what do you have to say about how phenomenal this kid is?
What's funny is that, like, even with how much he accomplished and how much he's done, can't you still think of so many fresh Tyler Bate matches? For even how, yeah, like how much he's been able to do this year, you could still possibly get like a Tyler Bate versus Keith Lee, or a Tyler Bate versus Walter, or something like Tyler Bate versus Zack Sabre Jr. hasn't been done that much at all. A Tyler Bate versus Speedball. Like, even with how much we've said about the variety he has in opponents and facing all these guys and having great matches with almost everyone he's been put out there against, there's still so much more he can do. And, like, that's just the beauty of this guy, is that, like, because he has such a well-rounded game with the technical wrestling, with the high-flying, with the power stuff, is that you can realistically want to see him against anybody and it wouldn't feel like a mismatch. Like, Tyler Bate versus Omari, who's a bigger freak athlete? That would be such fun to watch. Tyler Bate versus Mark Davis in a singles match would be great stuff to watch. But yeah, like the only thing that can hold this guy back is the fact that I thought in those British strong style six-man tags, in the bulk of them, they just weren't very good. There's a few that I thought were very good. The RingConf one specifically. I thought the Dragon Gate one over Project Mayhem was good. I thought the CCK one was good up until the finish, and they went into the Triple H bag. But even that, I don't even think I hated the British Strong Style Trio stuff as much as other people did. And I think just having a little bit more of a limited schedule with the WWE contract kind of changed his output a little bit, because he was going to be in 16 Karat and then got pulled from that. So you can only imagine what he could have been doing with a 16-carat boost on his resume. But, yeah, I love the guy. 20 years old, the whole world ahead of him. And you said it. There's absolutely no reason why this guy doesn't wind up as one of the best wrestlers of all time. Maybe the best of his generation. And we'll see how it goes. Fingers crossed that nothing terrible happens, or that WWE doesn't sign him up and then, like, he becomes a non-entity or something, but I just can't imagine a world where this guy isn't one of the best wrestlers to ever live.
Yeah, exactly. And just continuing to grow. So that was your 17, my 18?
Mm-hmm.
So then my 17, I doubt you'll have her higher, is Nikki Cross.
I don't have Nikki Cross, and this is just kind of surprising how high you have her, so let me hear it.
Okay, well, she's the star of NXT for 2017. She came out like a fucking fireball. She essentially was saddled with a gimmick that I think no one really was into, and she's the standout clearly in the Sanity group. Killer matches with Asuka from the second that they start going at it. Starts a feud with Ruby Riot that like stands out as just fucking amazing, with her mic work and her like just psychology game. Gets stuck into so many multi-woman matches, tag matches, all this stuff. And every time she just fucking brings it with the psychology and holding the matches together and carrying everyone, on top of her character work, her charisma, and her promo ability to just stand out as the biggest fucking star in the world. Takeover matches, she continuously is just like the big-time breakout star. The four-way with Asuka, Billie Kay, and Peyton Royce, she's just like clearly the star of the match. Big fucking spots everywhere. Stands out. Six-man tag, or I think it was a four-man tag, whatever it is, eight-man. She comes in and joins up with Sanity against the thrown-together team, Cassius Ohno, Roderick Strong, Ty Dillinger, and Ruby Riot. She's just a ball of energy all over the place in this fucking wild spot fest. Triple threat with her, Ruby Riot, and Asuka, the one with the double pin finish that that was just like going so smoothly and doing so well. I thought the finish was a little weird, but whatever. And then like, yeah, spinning out from there, just recently the fatal four way for the, vacant title. Again, I think that she holds the match together. She comes in for the big kind of hot tag sequence, fires everything up. Yeah, I mean, a big part of it is just she became a huge star. She leaps off the page. She's the most important. She feels like the most important part of every episode of NXT that she's on. She stands out within her group that really seems like they're just kind of just almost dead. They're actually starting to come back now, but there was times where she was the only thing worthwhile in the group, and sometimes she's the only thing worthwhile on the entire show. She's just, yeah, amazing. In-ring, out-ring, everything she does is, like, she just knocks it out of the park. So, yeah, I just, I really, really thought that she was great this entire year. And, yeah, that's kind of my take on Nikki Cross here.
The main thing I've always taken away from Nikki Cross in the time that she's been an on-screen character on NXT is that if you remember Nikki Cross from her, indie days, her biggest calling card was her promos. She was a fantastic promo, fantastic character, great at exuding this arrogance, this high and mightiness that was kind of unmatched. And now, in this Sanity role, she obviously is not doing too much talking. And if she is doing talking, it's in a completely different manner than what she was talking before. And I think this Sanity run has kind of proved that she's like sort of a method actor. Is that you can put her in any character, any situation, and I feel like Nikki Cross is just too talented to let it not work. I feel like you can make her do anything or give her any role, give her any position on the card, whether it be just on the outside to make faces and pace around outside the ring, whether it be actually being Asuka's biggest threat as a challenger, whether it be in these mixed tag matches or just making her presence felt in the ring. Nikki Cross is just always gonna stand out. And I was really worried when Sanity first started that they were gonna miss the boat on Nikki because they were giving her something that just didn't fit her. But I'm glad that it's worked out for her and that she just is too good to let something that probably isn't gonna work out for anybody else in Sanity hold her back.
Yeah, I mean, she took, like I said, took the ball and ran with it and has made herself into an even bigger commodity, I think, going forward. So that's my number 17.
All right, my number 16, you have higher since you haven't said him yet, but David Starr.
Yeah, I have him higher. So my number 16, I think you said him just a couple ago, is Speedball Mike Bailey.
Yeah, I had Speedball at, looks like 18.
I'm gonna let you start with Speedball because I've been taking up these these double talk ones.
Well, if my dog can get off of me, Speedball is someone where it sucks that he's had to miss so much time in the U.S. With the travel, with his travel being revoked. But in the time that he's been away, I think he's grown leaps and bounds as a wrestler. While I loved him a lot while he was in the U.S. and doing a lot of things in CZW and PWG and Evolve and wherever else he showed up, I felt like people kind of thought Speedball was one-dimensional, that he was just this Karate Kid character. And in the last 2 years, especially this year, I feel like he's shown that he's much more than that and that he's become super well-rounded. To start the year off, he has this fantastic match against Hiroshima. A great match with Zack Sabre Jr. at the Cockpit Show that I know you'll have a lot to say about. I think he and Kanesuke Takeshita and their feud for the KOD title definitely opened a lot of eyes, and for me, really showed me the potential there is for a Speedball heel run if he went all the way with it. I know that he did it in IWS with the whole being corrupted by California thing. But I really just love this disingenuous, insincere, Bo Dallas-esque character of smiling and laughing and having this friendly facade, but having this insidious underbelly to all these like seemingly go-happy, go-lucky mannerisms. I thought the Konosuke Takeshita match was the best New Japan, was the best non-New Japan match that happened in Japan for a while this year. You just saw it, but the Mike Bird match from Attack that just happened recently is fucking incredible. It's something that definitely boosts his case. The fucking Osprey match from the What Culture World Cup is one of my favorite matches that happened all year and features maybe my favorite spot that happened all year, which is a Shooting Star Meteora, which I absolutely still go gaga for. But yeah, I think his pacing has gotten better. I think he's really good at controlling a match. I mean, I didn't even mention his Sunny Kiss match from C4, which featured a lot of creative spots and featured Speedball controlling the match and letting Sunny Kiss work from underneath. It was in a really good tag match teaming with Kazusada Higuchi going up against Konosuke Takeshita and Diego. I just love everything this guy does. And it's a shame to me that because he's working in mainly Japan and Europe, that people aren't seeing how much he's grown as a performer. Because if people were a big fan of him back in his PWG and CZW runs, then they'd be really impressed by how far he's came in the last year or so.
Yeah, I mean, he's been amazing this year. Really put it together in a way that I did not expect. As someone who was a fan of his, but I did not see. And one match that you didn't mention that kind of showed it to me, because it was one of the first matches that I saw from him early on against Josh Alexander. He had a match against him again this year, early in the year in C4, that showed me just how much he's changed. He was really one-dimensional back when I first saw that match from early on in his career compared to now. He's really a lot more multifaceted as a wrestler. His UK stuff is really spotty, honestly. Even his Canada stuff is pretty spotty. But his solid work is primarily in DDT. Now, that's not to say that his stuff in Canada, in England, or in England isn't great, but it's just like it's few and far between. Not a lot of storyline stuff going on there. I thought Ambition Weekend, he had really good matches. ACH match. When I say Ambition Weekend, that really shows what matters to me. the 16 Karat Weekend. His Ambition match with Riddle, I thought was great. Well, yeah, this is coming after.
Yeah, I didn't even mention his Riddle stuff, which he having two Riddle matches in the same day, and those are completely different, which is an incredible feat to me.
And different from one of the, what I would put as a match of the year level match from the year before and beyond between the two. Then they come back and have two totally different matches that are just as good. The guy is just phenomenal. Always has great matches with Mao, who's a guy who I really like in DDT.
He has a Jordan Devlin match in OTT from early in the year that I forgot to mention. That was really good too.
Nice. Ashton Smith, one of Ashton Smith's best matches that I've seen this year. Not a guy that I really like that much, but still, that's saying something. The guy is just really good. The four-way in WXW for the world title, Yuen Simmons, Dieter, and Walter. I thought he was great in that match as well. What Culture in the World Cup, good match with Kyle O'Reilly, good match with Travis Banks.
Well, I forgot to mention that stuff. I really loved Mike Bailey versus Brent Banks. I love that Kyle O'Reilly match, and I think if it just happened in a promotion that isn't as eye-rolled or hated as What Culture, that it would have gotten a lot more praise.
Mm-hmm. Probably my favorite match of the King of DDT tournament against Endo, actually, which is probably kind of crazy for other people, but I just really, really loved that match. You talk about the Takeshita title match. I mean, we did a podcast about it, so obviously we both really enjoyed that match. He has like this really awesome charisma with Bucks Belmar every time. These guys have mixed it up over the years, they're both from Canada. They always have really cool matches. They had an IWS match here this year that was really good. Bucks Belmar coming out of retirement, I think, right around the same time. Smash Wrestling did him and Bobby Lashley that I loved, just completely loved. Him versus Tom Lawler in C4. I talked about that match when I talked about Tom Lawler. The match with Kushida in What Culture is fantastic. The match with Will Ospreay in the World Cup match was really good. The guy has a lot of great matches. And then There's the big one that you kind of mentioned, which for me, big one for me, the match with Zack Sabre Jr. at the cockpit. We both have talked about how much we love the cockpit shows. I think for us, the cockpit shows are kind of the best shows that RevPro puts on throughout the year. And that match against Zack Sabre Jr. I think ends up in my match of the year list. I think it probably flies under a lot of people's radar, but it's been a mixture of amazing and befuddling to me the entire year. I just can't really put my finger on it. And me and you kind of talked it through the other day, and I think it really kind of hammered home the idea of what it is with that match that kind of tickled my fancy. It's that it was like the optimum dream match, and you rarely see that. It was this kind of concept of like, oh, what would it be like to see Mike Bailey versus Zack Sabre Jr.? And they completely delivered on like kind of every account of what you were hoping for. It was a mixture of both styles. It was a lot of great underdog selling from Speedball, Zack as a cocky prick asshole, domineering on the top, underdog babyface fire from Speedball that was great. It was also reined in and not insane, like Speedball kind of got sometimes in PWG. It was like within balance. It wasn't nutty. It was just, it was really this perfect dream match that just never happens. There's so many times you like, oh, imagine if these guys faced each other, what it would be like, and it never delivers. But that one really delivered exactly what I was hoping for in the match, and I think is part of why like it was reserved. It wasn't crazy. It didn't like slap me in the face, but I think that's why it was just so well balanced that I like really appreciated it. Loved his match against Josh Bodum for the British Cruiserweight title. And Josh Bodum's a guy who I'm like hit or miss with. I thought that match was really good. And then you talk about that Mike Bird match. That match was fucking great and had some really cool spots. We talked about it earlier on the first part of the show. So, yeah, he's just a all-around amazing wrestler. Flies under the radar for a lot of people just due to not being in America, not being in the same places that he was before. But, I mean, still putting together a really, really great list of matches year after year, continuously just getting better and better.
All right. And to move on, that was your 16, right?
That is my 16, yes.
All right. And 15, a guy where he missed your list last year, and I'm going to be very disappointed if he has missed it again. But my number 15 is Kento Miyahara.
Yeah, he did.
Damn, man.
And no, but here's the thing is I watched him this year. Last year, I hadn't seen the matches. This year, I saw the matches, and I just wasn't into it.
Right.
I'm perfectly honest. I watched, and the thing is, he would have been on my list last year if I had watched the matches before we did the list, because I really did love him in his title reign last year, but this year I just didn't see it. And I watched like pretty much everything. I watched all the Champions Carnival. I watched all of his title matches. I just didn't get into him. So, I mean, change my mind. Tell me why I'm wrong.
I feel like every time he was in a singles match this year, this guy just fucking delivered. Against Kai, against Jake Lee, against Shuji in both title matches, against Takao Amori, against the Bodyguard, of all fucking people, against Suwama, against Joe Doering. You know, it's just, for me, I don't think anyone really just goes as hard as Kento when it comes to these singles matches. Like, I don't think Kento leaves anything. I don't think Kendall leaves like anything off the table. I feel like he's just going to go out there and give his all. He's going to sell his ass off, and he's going to have like very genuine feeling comeback spots, even if it's kind of formulaic. I think he knows how to change it up more than people give him credit for. Especially in regards to that Bodyguard match where they were in Osaka and he let the Bodyguard fight from underneath as opposed to doing the typical Kento formula. I love the Suwama match. From, I want to say October, as it was the first, Triple Crown match after the big Sumo Hall show. And that was just Kento getting his leg torn apart and selling the hell out of it. I love the Kai match and how it really showed people that Kai can be great still, but Kento was there just destroying his leg. The Jake Lee match where he's facing his tag team partner and they just go all out and it feels like a star-making performance for Jake Lee. Takao Mori, a guy that's up there in age, and they've had plenty of singles matches against each other, but they just keep delivering. even if people aren't ever particularly interested in them, whenever those matches happen and I watched them, like, damn, that was really fucking good. Great tag team work, still great in trios matches, so it's not like he takes the night off. For me, even if it was a year where he didn't have the belt throughout the entire time, Kento Miyahara still felt must-watch. And that's something that I think we talked about earlier with Aaron Simmons, is that when he has the belt, it feels elevated. But even when he doesn't have the belt, he does feel like he's still important and like the biggest deal in the company.
Yeah, that's very, very fair. But I guess I just didn't get into a lot of his matches. I thought the bodyguard match was good, but I actually thought there was better bodyguard matches this year. And I just didn't. And like I said, I would have had him on my list last year if I had watched the matches in time. But this year, I just probably would still have not had him on my list. My number 15, I don't think you'll have, honestly, is Fred Yehi.
Fred Yehi higher.
Oh, you do? Jesus, okay.
All right. My number 14, I know you have higher, but it's Jonathan Gresham.
Yeah, I've got him higher. So my number 14, maybe, I don't remember if you said him earlier, Mark Haskins?
I had Mark Haskins at 30.
Okay. So Mark Haskins has been literally the best wrestler on the planet. As soon as he got back, at times he is just impressively amazing. When he shows back up after his injury, he has a just killer Match of the Year contender match against Mark Andrews, solid match against Matt Riddle, continues to have great matches throughout Progress. Axel Dieter, he's just the guy that they stick him in anywhere. Random title match against Pete Dunne in Orlando in a great match. Title match against Zack Sabre Jr. in Orlando, great match. I mean, matches against Travis Banks repeatedly in great matches. Luke Forever, he gets the title and then starts a heel run that's phenomenal. That heel run actually transitions into a heel run in Progress that's been really good so far. Great mix, you know, as the veteran in like a three-way match with him and Banks and Strickland, able to really kind of lead and control the match. Great matches with Tyler Bates repeatedly. Great match with Kyle Fletcher. Tagging with Havoc, like I talked about, becomes like this really cool just dynamic that they have together that then continues to grow and is just super awesome and fun to watch. Great match with Austin Theory when he shows back up in New York for the Evolve 91 and then leading into Bola this year. The match with Travis Banks to open up was really fucking good. Banks pass match Bola weekend this year. Really just fucking phenomenal the whole way through. Last Man Standing match with Chris Ridgeway, super great drama, violent, aggressive, phenomenal stuff. Really, really big fan of the dude. Has some really great matches. Just fucking oozes intensity. Really comes back from retirement and essentially is just better than ever. All heart, all drama, all emotion, technically crisp, precise, super cool spots, bringing in the wife to have this dynamic character with deeper emotion and storytelling involved. Just one of the best going, one of the easiest to appreciate his matches for me just because of his mix of style and everything that he does. I just fucking love the dude. So that's kind of my take on Haskins. What do you got on Haskins here?
There's also a couple matches that you didn't mention that I really liked. The Zack Sabre Jr. match from WrestleMania weekend at Mercury Rising I thought was very good. A match you really liked from the Dream Tag Team Invitational from the second night, Travis Banks versus Mark Haskins. But yeah, everything you said, the fact that this guy came back from like the brink of retirement again is kind of nuts. And then not only that, came back and was able to compete at a high level literally right away in his first match is fucking insane. The tag team with Jimmy Havoc, I'm in the camp where I didn't really like the story, where it was going. As far as when it was a singles feud between the two, and now that they've joined them together in this like unholy trinity with Vicky Haskins in the middle of it, they're this intimidating and aggressive and gruesome tag team that just annihilate and destroy people. I'm not sure if you ever got to that match, but Jack Sexsmith and Matt Riddle versus Jimmy Havoc and Mark Haskins from Chapter 57 is really great stuff. But yeah, everything you said about Mark Haskins and just perennially just one of the best wrestlers in the world. And I feel like he's just always going to be one of those guys that just floats in that like top 10, top 15 range of just being one of those guys where you start listing off who's been the best this year and you just can't go far without naming him.
Yeah, I agree with you in every way there. That match, the tag team match, was just starting when I paused the show last night when I went to sleep, so that's on the docket to be watched next.
So we're on 13 now, right?
Yeah, you're 13 here.
All right, my 13, you haven't said yet, so you have higher, but Liverpool's number one, Zach Gibson.
I do not, he did not make my top 50. Unfortunately,
wow.
I know, and you know that I was in love with him all last year,
but that is shocking.
He ended up in the 60s. Let me check here. 68, actually, is where he ended up.
Damn.
Hard drop for him, but I didn't like the Grizzled Young Vets team.
I guess you should get into like what led to such a big drop because. This is kind of shocking for me.
I don't like the Grizzled Young Vets team. I feel like he's disappeared a lot of places. He's not showing up as much. It doesn't have the same focus that he used to have. His promo work, while still works, is becoming the same thing over and over again to the point where it's just really annoying, even if the crowd gets into it. And I almost kind of feel that the crowd is doing it in a postmodern way where they just feel like they're hitting their spot they're supposed to boo, and it's not really about heat like it used to be. And I just think, like I said, I think his work itself in the ring hasn't been as focused and as good as it used to be, especially in tag team settings, unfortunately, because I do think he still has that skill, and I think that he could still be a top level guy. I just think he's missing it. He's missing the chance to do all that work.
So I guess where we differ is that I really do enjoy the Grizzled Young Vets team. Honestly, before Havoc and Haskins came around, I thought that was the team that was really going to give the UK tag scene the kick in the ass it needed as far as a heel tag team that was actually heelish and aggressive and mean and nasty. I still think the Grizzled Young Vets offer that. It gives James Drake something to do, and I think like unlocks the potential he had hidden in him that people, I guess, weren't really seeing when he first started popping up. Credit that to Zach Gibson, who just just a really dependable guy and will always be able to get the best out of somebody. I think he was able to get the best out of somebody like Dan McGee early on in the year. Dan McGee, who's a trainee at RevPro, and Zach Gibson is having a compelling match with him early on in the Jack Sexsmith run when people weren't really sure what to make of Jack Sexsmith in this whole being taken seriously thing, and they go out there and have a great match of progress. I think Zach Gibson had a phenomenal run as Future Shock World Champ with James Drake by his side being this cheating heel that did all this typical Zach Gibson stuff, but I guess a little bit more underhanded than before. I think he walks that line perfectly with being able to make fun of himself and make himself be the butt of the joke while also being able to be taken seriously as a credible ass kicker and threat and big menace, because he is a very big dude. So even if he is a joke one night, you can be scared of him the next. One of his signature spots this year has become him slipping on the turnbuckle, and in turn that leads to him getting pinned or rolled up or whatever. And I think that's a very brilliant touch by him. the Progress New York match against Jack Gallagher as a surprise since Pete Dunne got injured was fantastic and probably better than I think Pete Dunne and Gallagher would have done, honestly. I think the Beyond match against John Silver was very good too for a good mid-card match between a very likable and determined babyface against this big, formidable heel. I still think he's the best heel in wrestling. Granted, I think the booing has become part of his act now, but I still think that when he talks in the microphone and he gathers more and more and more heat, they're not just booing him because you're supposed to boo Zach Gibson. I think he's also eliciting that reaction and earning it too. So yeah, I think still being the best heel in wrestling, probably the undisputed best heel in wrestling this year to me, through and through. Because there are guys that I think have better, had better heel performances, like a Zack Sabre Jr., like a Thatcher, like a Pete Dunne, but they're not through and through heels. They're not heels in every promotion where they are. Every single place Zach Gibson goes, he is a heel. So to me, that is the mark of being the best heel in wrestling. And when you're getting strong heat in every single promotion and you're having quality matches, them being a good roadblock for anybody, or you can be the top guy, or you can be in an awesome tag team, then I just have to have you high on my list.
Yeah, and he is a kind of plug-and-play guy. He's like you said, he's the same everywhere. He gets the same reaction everywhere. He plays the same character everywhere, so it really does work in that regard. His OTT stuff has been good this year. Maybe I should have been paying attention to Future Shock, and that would have helped him, but also part of it, too, is this year has been the story of my kind of falling out of love with Progress, and even someone like Mark Haskins, who did a good job, good work in Progress, to me made more of a case outside of Progress than he did within. And Zach Gibson, unfortunately, a lot of his best stuff I think was in Progress, and it's just not resonating with me, unfortunately.
All right, to move on, who's your 13?
My 13 is, I think you just said him a little bit ago, but it's Keith Lee.
I had Keith Lee at 28.
28. So I'll let you start on Keith Lee. How's that sound? Let me do it. Yeah, let me go for it, because you just got done talking. How's that?
Go ahead.
Okay, so Keith Lee, great matches with Donovan Dijak repeatedly. Always these really cool, groundbreaking matches. Fantastic match with David Starr early in the year. Still wrapping up his ROH stuff. All of those tag matches in ROH were always fucking great. I just thought that the Pretty Boy Killers was such a good tag team. Unfortunately, cut short due to that. They had good matches in Beyond early in the year. Talked about it with EYFBO. Talked about it with the Hit Squad. From there, good stuff in Texas. Great match with Sammy Guevara in Inspire this year. Really, probably Sammy Guevara's best match. Phenomenal match from Keith Lee. Keith Lee, his push in Evolve really continued to move on and was creating some really cool stuff. Gets a big win on Zack Sabre Jr. the night before Zack wins the title. He's been just a breakout star in PWG. The crowd fell in love with him instantly. Good stuff with Leo Rush in a lot of different places. Good stuff with Ricochet in a few different places. Great matches with Jeff Cobb in a few different places. Just really an all-around guy who oozes big, larger-than-life charisma. You could say biggest stumbling block may have been the match with Kyle O'Reilly. People didn't like the finish on that. I liked the match up until the end. Also the match with in Beyond against Mike Elgin, I think a lot of people may have not liked as much. I thought it was fine, not his best work. Match with Pentagon in AAW for the Heritage title I thought was worked really well. Trevor Lee match in PWG was fucking great. Again, match with Fred Yehi I thought was really good. Like I said, oozes big-time charisma. Has a bunch of good matches with Matt Riddle as well. Decent match with Ethan Page in Evolve, which is impressive because it's Ethan Page. Just a guy who really leaps off the page again. Big time star presence. Can have good matches with everyone. Can mix up his style, which you don't kind of expect from a big man like him, but he can. He can go balls to the walls, high octane with Dijak when he needs to be. He can be the giant beating up the little. the little guy. He can also get worked over if he needs to be. He can kind of do it all. Showed his wind, showed his stamina in Bola, making it all the way to the finals, never getting gassed out. Loved his match with Ray Phoenix, loved the match with Dijak, match with Walters, fucking great. Just the final itself, I thought probably the best PWG Bola final in years. The guy is, he's just a freak of nature. You watch him and you gotta stop and stare when you see him in person, when you see him in the building, you just have to kind of continue to look at him. You can't, you cannot look away. Unfortunately, he's just too much. He draws your attention. He's, like I said, able to work psychology, drama, big matches, small matches, lucha libre. He can do it all. And it's really impressive for a guy his size, at his age, to be able to pull off so much.
Well, I did have Keith Lee very high, and I think he's had a tremendous output and has shown a ton of variety this year. I think this year was also kind of exposing him, honestly. In 2016, when we first get introduced to Keith Lee, because on a widespread scale, because he starts working in Beyond, and then that opens the doors for everybody else to get their eyes on him. You know, he's this big, like, oh man, where'd this guy come from? He can do this? Where has he been this whole time? And I'm glad people got to discover them too. Like, I'm not, like, opposed to that. But I think, to me, 2017 showed that we should probably keep Keith Lee as a special attraction and that we probably shouldn't try to build around him. He doesn't seem like a guy that we should be building promotions around. I think that was clear and evolved to me as we got closer to him winning the WWN title. I don't know. Something about Keith just hasn't clicked with me as much as I would have liked it to this year. It's not to the same degree as, like, Shane Strickland or Phoenix or Tony Storm. That's where I expected them to have big 2017s, and I just wound up not caring as much. But I don't know. To me, it just felt like Keith Lee firmly established himself as a special attraction and not somebody that I could see a promotion building itself around. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. You can still be a special attraction and do your job and have great matches and draw and do all that stuff. But for Keith Lee, someone so talented and charismatic and as versatile as he is, I was just hoping we would see a year where I could see Keith Lee being the top guy in a promotion. And as it stands right now, I'm not sure he can do that.
I can see where you're coming from based on the kind of the stuff that happened in Evolve WWN, but I mean his championship run in Inspire I thought was done really well, and he came across like a big deal and the top guy. And I think that in PWG right now, I think he feels like he could be the top guy for companies like that. So it is, I think it really depends on the booking and the way that he's used it. But yeah, we'd have to see. I mean, in what settings he'd be able to pull it off, because he is not the stereotypical top guy, that's for sure.
And not even in a stereotypical way, I think, I don't know. I feel like it's a different thing to me, where I see Keith Lee coming to town, and I'm not sure I'll be as interested in seeing him have title defense after title defense after title defense. I have to see how it's booked, and who's booking it, and where it is. But granted, a lot of people just aren't good at booking world champions. And I feel like Keith Lee goes all over the place so much between what he wants to be and what he wants to do. And that can be a hindrance sometimes with guys that they're so good at everything that they just want to show that off and not like settle down on one thing. That when you're a world champion, you kind of have to. And that I'm not sure Keith Lee is going to be willing to do that. I don't know.
Yeah, I can definitely see where you're coming from. So I guess what's your number 12?
My number 12, you have not said this guy yet, so if he's higher on your list than I have him, after you've just kind of not been high on him this year, I'd be surprised. But number 12 is Matt Riddle.
Yeah, no Matt Riddle this year for me.
Okay, that's interesting.
So tell me about him, bro.
You had him at 20 last year, and that was very controversial, and now not at all this year.
Not in the 50. I probably have him in my top 100.
Okay.
But I think that my issues with him last year have just gotten worse this year, if I'm perfectly honest.
I think it's very easy to take Matt Riddle's 2017 for granted. He came on the scene so hot last year, just having great matches with everybody, getting booked everywhere, getting all these dream matches, getting treated like a star, so that it's kind of easy to just take it for granted when it's just more of the same in 2017. That being said, that doesn't mean that he wasn't having great matches. It doesn't mean that volume-wise, he wasn't going out there and having great matches on every single show he was on. Still in Evolve, killing it on pretty much every single show. Whenever he showed up in PWG, I thought the Chosen Bros tag team got a lot better as the year went on. And showing up in every single indie, Rev Pro, Progress, all over the world, just coming in, being one of the most in-demand stars all over the world and killing it every time asked of him. I think what separates him this year is that if you thought that Matt Riddle didn't have the variety last year, then you know what? Fine. He kind of stayed and Evolve and wrestled the same guys over and over again, so I could see it then. 2017, this guy is wrestling Gunnar Miller in a great sprint. Has a great match with Tank in Tank's last match. A really awesome match with Nick Gage. Really fun match with Matt Tremont and Beyond. I think the Dijak stuff in Beyond was really good performances on Riddle's end and kind of lacking on Dijak's end, if I'm being honest. But I think what I have to say about Riddle is that I can kind of get being disappointed in some ways by it because it was just more of the same. But this is still a guy that's in his second year wrestling, honestly. For me, the fact that this guy has had even bigger output and even bigger variety than he had in 2016 shows improvement, shows growth. And when someone has a year as wildly praised as Matt Riddle's was, as being the best rookie year of all time, then naturally some people expect it to just be, oh, he's going to be the best wrestler of the year now. He's not just going to be the best rookie. Well, obviously that's just not going to happen that way. And you have to have some kind of semblance of expectations, even if the bar was set so high. The guy is still just outside of my top 10 in his second, after 2.5 years of being a wrestler. And that is showing something to me. And I think he showed variety and the fact that he can keep growing. And I think he's the best. I think he makes fighting spirit spots seem natural. I don't think anybody else does it as naturally as he does. The way he rolls out of a German suplex, the way he screams, the bro war cry, all of it just works for him in a way that it just doesn't work for anybody else in the indie scene. It doesn't feel genuine. It just works for him. And I feel like Matt Riddle's kind of found a niche, and that niche may not be for everybody else, but I don't think that turns into the fact that this guy suddenly isn't one of the best wrestlers in the world.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely see where you're coming from, and it's partially just that his style, what he does, doesn't speak to me. But you make a lot of really good arguments there for him, honestly. He's not... he's obviously very good. All right, so my number 12, I think you just said a little bit ago as well, is Jonathan Gresham.
I had Gresham at 14.
Okay, and, I mean, if this was just the best technical wrestler kind of thing, I think there's almost no argument to say that John Gresham isn't the winner. If it's just 100% about, in-ring grappling, he's probably, number one. When you account for everything else, he does lack a lot of character and charisma early in the year. It's always been an issue for him. I feel like just recently putting it together with Stokely Hathaway, he's really come out of his shell in a way that's, I think, is actually possibly workable as a top level talent kind of guy. I do think that there's more there. This year, great matches with Jay Freddy early in the year. Good stuff on ROH TV, battling off and on for the TV title. getting title shots, earning title shots, tagging with Search and Destroy, primarily with the Chris Sabin, Alex Shelley, having really great matches there. Good stuff in Beyond constantly, really the star of Beyond, always having phenomenal matches. The Look in California, Feel in Minnesota weekend, good match with Elgin, which is impressive. Good match tagging with the Zack Sabre Jr. against Doom Patrol. Fred Yehi and Nova Pro, phenomenal match. Again, against Jordan Grace and Beyond. Good stuff. Match against John Skyler and PWX. Average, like, decent, solid match, but John Skyler to me in 2017 was not great. Flip Gordon match in ROH is good. Turns around and then has a phenomenal match with Flip Gordon and Beyond later on for the Powerbomb TV title. Great match on ROH TV against Punisher Martinez. I really, really, really loved that match for kind of a squash matchy thing. I thought he did a really good job in that setting. Match with Tracer X and PWX that I loved. Match with TK Orion on ROH TV that I thought was very good. And then, yeah, winning the Powerbomb TV title, he is mixing in this integration of cool heel stuff, working with Stokely, the jumping stomps, the working over the body parts, the just being a total shit as this little, like, 5'3", 100-pound soaking wet, little nothing as this fucking ruthless asshole heel is just so, so good. And so, like, he's just really, really believable there. So, yeah, I'm just... super high on the guy, amazing technical wrestler, has great matches with anyone, no matter how experienced they are, no matter how talented they are, whatever it is, he always has great matches. Really good on ROH TV, honestly the star of on ROH TV up until the point where I stopped watching, which is like in the middle of the year. Probably continued to be the star of the ROH TV after that point. As I did see some stuff here and there, he's always the guy that I would go out of my way to look for his matches, even on ROH TV still after I stopped paying attention. So yeah, just, all around phenomenal worker. As I talked about, putting together that charisma, really starting to feel like a champion, carrying himself like a champion now as the Powerbomb TV title. And then that match with Nick Gage just a couple weeks back, really, again, showed Nick Gage had a good match with David Starr, with John Grisham that weekend. I think I preferred the John Grisham match. I think Grisham really brought it out of Nick, and it wasn't just a death match with barbed wire and all this. He actually had a lot more to it. So, to me, I just think, yes, immensely talented in pretty much every possible way. Clearly one of the best in-ring wrestlers on the planet, and just has just talent in spades, I guess. Damn it, I shouldn't have said that. That's, like, slightly racist. that could be seen as, like, a weird racial... No, he's just, like, immensely talented. It's just, like, fucking insane how good he is, honestly. So tell me why he was so low on your list. Why didn't you have him any higher, huh?
I had Gresham a lot lower last year, and I feel like I just didn't fully appreciate him and what he was doing all throughout the world. Now I think I was just looking at him every single time he showed up this year, and I'm like, I don't think per performance there was anybody better than Jonathan Gresham this year. Maybe somebody that I have higher, and that we'll talk about that on the third part. But per performance, there aren't many people that I could be like, well, this person was great in this match, even if the match wasn't great. And this happened with Gresham so many times this year, where even if the match itself wasn't great, Gresham is always great in it. Against Brian Cage at American Rana, having a damn near 4-star match by himself, pretty much. And it's not to say that Cage was bad in it. Cage was selling his leg and had great power stuff, but that was a Gresham performance. Against Jay Freddy, against Will Ferrara. You mentioned the John Skyler match. I do love that match. I think I'm also higher on Skyler 2017 than you, but that's fine. The Doom Patrol match is real good. And I'm not sure if you mentioned the Michael Elgin match that was really good. The four-way with Gresham, Jay Freddy, David Starr, and Joey Janela was really good. I just feel like every time I see the guy, I just get wowed. And it's not that he's having 4-star matches or whatever every single time he's out there. It's just that every single time he's in the ring, you feel like you're watching the best wrestler in the world. And not many people have that quality. And I can't believe we, like, did all this without even mentioning the first Fred Yehi match with Nova Pro, which was absolutely stellar, mat-based wrestling and great logical pro wrestling. And they had a rematch last week or a couple of weeks ago that I'm really excited to see whenever that goes up on Powerbomb TV. He's also facing Sanjay Dutt very soon, which should be excellent. So yeah, just Gresham, every time he is on my screen, I come away thinking, damn, like this might be the best wrestler on the planet. And even if his high-end stuff doesn't match the guys that are above him, that doesn't change the fact that whenever I see Gresham, I'm just like blown away.
Yeah, and the Fred Yehi match, the first one was phenomenal. I haven't seen the second one yet either. I'm really excited to see the rematch just because of how good the first match was. You know what, you hit the nail on the head there, is that he, when you watch him wrestle, you feel like he's the best wrestler on the planet, and that's like really, really impressive that he has that aura to his work and to every one of his matches. Okay, so that was my 12, I guess. What's your number 11?
My number 11, now that we're on this number, we'll be able to wrap it up after this. But my number 11 is Will Ospreay.
Talk about him.
Did not make your list, I see.
No, that's I was gonna. Yeah, I thought maybe you would thought he would, but no, he did not. Let me hear about Ospreay, because I just didn't see it this year.
I've said it pretty much the entire year that this was a year of significant growth for the guy. I thought that was evident as early as February of this year. And really, I thought it was evident in late 2016, when he officially turns, on Jimmy Havoc, and turns heel in Progress. And I think, that show technically came out this year. So, I count that as for his 2017 resume, but, that match in a boxing live against Jimmy Havoc is fucking tremendous and an amazing Will Ospreay performance, where that story and everything behind it is purely told by Will Ospreay's facial expressions. From the scowls, the disgust, the anger, the disdain, the apprehension, the fear, he goes through a whole range of emotions because he's facing a man that put him through hell. And then he's looking at him for the first time in a long time, and he's getting cheered. And Will Ospreay doesn't know how to react, especially coming off this big losing streak. And at the end of it, Will Ospreay just snaps. I loved his match against Mark Andrews from Chapter 45, where they come up with a finish on the fly based on the fact that the top rope snapped. I really love the blow-off feud ender at Chapter 46 against Jimmy Havoc. It's kind of goofy. There's a lot going on. It's overbooked. But it tells the story of these two guys that have been intertwined for such a long time. And it is this poetic ending to this feud that saw both men go through hell. Will Ospreay saw this company that he fought tooth and nail to save and keep away from the evil hands of Jimmy Havoc, then praise Jimmy Havoc and worship the ground he walks on. And Will Ospreay is sitting here losing, and then he's expected to be this guy to shake hands and let bygones be bygones. And he doesn't allow that. I thought his work in New Japan this year was really good for the most part. I thought the Best of Super Juniors final was really good against Kushida, and possibly is like a top 10, 15 match whenever I get around to rewatching it. I thought the King of Pro Wrestling match against Kushida was really great. But I think he really makes that late push around August, September, when that What Culture World Cup starts to kick into high gear. And he just goes on this incredible run going up against Speedball, Rey Mysterio, Ricochet, and Kushida in a span of two nights, or three nights, really. The Rey Mysterio match was just great. Sort of a student versus teacher matchup going with the psychology of the 619 and building to that spot, and who can hit their big move first. Just very well built and very well paced, that felt like an actual dream match and delivered on that level fully. The Speedball match, which I was talking about with Speedball's case earlier, is one of the biggest bangers of the year. super exciting, high flying stuff, unique reversals, and creative stuff that only those two could probably pull off. The Ricochet match, another installment of their feud, where I think Will Ospreay doesn't get enough credit for having different matches with most of the guys he faces. Even if I don't want to watch the matches a lot of the time, I feel like he usually is pretty good at adding a new wrinkle into whenever he faces a guy again. I think that showed pretty well against Zack Sabre Jr. at Global Wars Night 2, where with a firmly heel Zack Sabre Jr., Will Ospreay and Zack Sabre Jr. had a completely different match than anything they've had in the last 2 years. A lot of this comes from the fact that Will Ospreay spent so much time in Australia and New Zealand, and he's having great matches against Robbie Eagles and Adam Brooks, and eventually led to a triple threat against them at a big MCW show. And I think that Robbie Eagles match is utterly fantastic. It's hard-hitting. It's nasty as hell. So other than just having great matches and just a ton of them to boast, I think his pacing got better. I think his striking is worlds better, to the point where he's probably one of the best strikers in all of wrestling, and I'm firmly comfortable saying that. He's still one of the best flyers. He can be a great heel when he wants to. He can still do great tag team wrestling. He can be a genuinely rootable for babyface. Even with all the social media stuff and everything that's kind of like ruined like believing in that, when he wrestles, I think I'm still able to like believe in Will Ospreay. I don't know. I just feel like watching this guy grow so much after seeing a 2016 where it kind of felt like he was lashing out at critics and going overboard on things that he knew made them mad. I thought 2017 was a return to Will Ospreay trying to focus on just being the best wrestler he can and not letting other things get to him.
It's a fair case. He definitely had some big matches in there. You didn't even mention the Attack Pro match against Pete Dunne that I thought was really match. Fucking good.
The first match of DTTI against Travis Banks, that was really good.
Yes, that match was also great. I'll give him this. When What Culture Pro Wrestling booked the, you know, Mr. and Mrs. match with Ricochet and Tessa Blanchard versus Ospreay and B. Presley, he was definitely the second best member of his team. I'll give him that much. I'll say that. No, I don't hate the guy, wrestling-wise. Personally, he seems like a bit of a dipshit, but that's not what we're judging here. But a whole lot of the same, a whole lot of nothing, a whole lot of flips for the sake of flips, a few really, really, really good matches in there. You talked about it, but I think he's just a little bit too immature to stick to shit that he says. And one of the glaring things to me is like kind of cutting this teary-eyed promo about I'm going to be so committed to Australia now and I'm going to move here and live here, and he hasn't been back since then. And so it's just, I think when he's on, he's definitely one of the best in the world. I think that he shows some of the best talent around. I just think that he has like no self-control. No ability to just focus and have like these good matches every time. He wants to have fun in wrestling, and I think that it affects a lot of stuff because he cares more about that. I don't know. Did you mention the Jay White match in ROH? Phenomenal.
Yeah, I didn't even mention the Jay White match from Best in the War of the Worlds, I think, and the Flip Gordon match that I love from Global Wars. So yeah, I love both of those matches too. So. Again, like there's just so many Will Ospreay matches.
He has a lot of really good matches, and he probably should be in my top 50, you know, but he just annoys me, and it makes me hard to enjoy his matches because there's so much talent there that's wasted.
No, I get it. Like, this is a personal list, too. So, like, this is also going to come down to, like, personal feelings in some way. Just like how I said, like I don't care about Toni Storm. So like realistically, she has like a output that matches top 50. I just don't care about her. And when someone like actively annoys you, there's probably just a better chance they're not going to make your list. Like have you noticed, like Sami Callihan hasn't popped up on either of our lists.
Yeah. Oh, well, I just figured that's because we both had him number one.
Well, obviously.
That's what's of course.
Low key match of the year.
Maybe Loki's best match of the year. Okay, so my number 11, I am really torn up right now because I'm thinking about it and I'm like, I wonder if you have him higher. I honestly kind of think that you don't, and then it's going to be crazy because I think you might not have him on your list at all. My number 11 is Trevor Lee.
I have Trevor Lee higher.
Oh, okay. That's a pleasant surprise because I thought maybe he didn't make your list. I guess just to say, I mean, that's a huge drop, obviously, for me, going from number 1 last year to number 11. That's a 10-spot drop. But I guess we'll be talking about him later then.
We'll get into that on the next installment of the top 50. I actually have him in terms of the top 10 kind of low, so we'll be getting to him relatively early when we do that. But that wraps up this installment. Did not really do any
plugs. Suppressa S. Lucha. No,
We didn't really do any plugs last time, but I'm assuming like everybody knows who you are.
Yeah, figure it out.
You can follow me on Twitter at @QC_Moody if you don't already. If you don't follow me, then I have no idea why you're listening to my podcast.
Follow me on Untappd at @LuchaUndead. Look at the beers that I drink and get jealous because I waited in line for the newest, hottest, hazy IPA. That's my plug.
I wish I was a beer guy so I could revel in all these fancy beer names you have.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's it for this time. Part 3 will be coming to your ear holes shortly, so thanks for listening.